welcome to episode 11 of the Gut Munchers podcast. I'm your host, John, and with me this time around is my good buddy, Ed Demko. How you doing, Ed?
Very good. How you doing?
Not bad at all. Well, we have an exciting show this time. I guess I should stop calling them bonus shows since we seem to do one every damn month, and I should just probably break down and admit this is a bi-weekly podcast, but I refuse to do so. So this is going to be the bonus show for July that shows up at the beginning of August. So it makes no sense, but I don't care. It's episode 11. Get over it.
It's the Jalogist episode.
It's the Jalogist episode. See, you made a new word. That's awesome.
I know. Yeah. I should be getting royalties for this. I'm telling you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I should be getting royalties since you did it on my show and all, you know, rights pending or whatever. And, you know,
I didn't. I just want a percentage. That's all.
That works.
Okay.
Anyway, we have a great interview for this show. David Gregory, who is the director of a little movie called Plague Town, which recently came out from that's Dark Sky, right?
Yeah, and he also works a lot with a film company. What film company is that?
Yes, he's one of the co-founders of Severin. And before that, he worked for Blue Underground. And I think by now everybody knows how you and I feel about Blue Underground.
Yes, we don't like them at all.
Oh, really? Because I thought we did a tribute show.
Yeah, this is the opposite segment has just ended. It was only 2 seconds long on the show.
Oh, okay.
So
David Gregory has some great stories to tell about shooting his movie and then about working with Severin and working with Blue Underground, which I think is, excuse me, guys, I think is a great interview, if I do say so myself. But, of course, we don't just bring you stuff like that. Ed and I are going to review 3 Severin titles.
Haha.
Yes. See how we tied that together? Aren't we clever that way?
Yeah, and look at us doing all kinds of work. We're watching movies and putting an interview on here. I mean, this is taxing stuff.
Yeah, man, I'm sweating like a pig. Yeah. Actually, I am. It's hotter than hell in here.
Yeah,
it's the AC on. It's humidity, man. AC doesn't touch humidity sometimes.
I totally agree with you. The summers we both have, even though we're in different places, are pretty much the same, I would say. Nice and sticky and fucking humid.
Brother, we're both in the Midwest. It is what it is.
That's it.
Yeah, so.
What can you do?
Can't do anything. But anyway, so we're going to talk about 3 Severin titles. We're going to talk about Bloody Moon, which is, I think, a criminally underrated slasher film from, of all people,
Jesus Franco.
Jesus Franco. Oh, see, I thought it was Jess. I didn't know it was Jesus.
Yeah. You know what's funny? It actually says on the back of the box, director Jesus Franco.
Jesus makes some pretty sleazy movies.
Yeah, and on a side note, I know this has nothing to do with this, but I just thought this was funny. I was talking to you before the show about I saw a triple feature of Jim Wynorski flicks last night, and there was this movie. It's called Cry of the Winged Serpent. Okay, yeah. And I was watching this movie, and it's terrible, right? But I thought it was hilarious because it has to do with like drug lords and these police and stuff. And during one of the scenes in the movie, I didn't even realize it at this point, but the one cop's like, "Well, we're gonna have to go to the top," and the other cop's like, "Well, what are you talking about?" He's like, "Franco. It all starts with Jesus Franco." So, yeah, they actually named a drug lord in the movie Jesus Franco, which I thought was hilarious.
That's awesome. I just saw a Jim Wynorski movie.
Yeah, which one's that?
Ghoulies 4. I did. You think I'm kidding, don't you?
No. The funny thing is I had a total education in Jim Wynorski last night. Mm-hmm. Like, I found out that apparently he makes a dickload of Cinemax skin flicks under, like, alternate names and stuff, and he's still making those to this day.
That's where he makes his money, dude.
Yeah, really? Because I would have thought he would have made all his millions off Chopping Mall.
No, Chopping Mall's a kid. Chopping Mall is one of the few Jim Wynorski movies that I really love. Sorry. Not trying to get into the dude, but...
No, I totally agree. As far as I could tell, it's the only one that I really, really enjoy.
Have you seen Ghoulies 4?
I think so, but God, it's been a while. I don't remember it at all.
As bad as I thought it was going to be. But anyway, this is not a Jim Wynorski show.
No, it's just, I see what happens when I just need to talk about Jesus Franco for a second.
True that.
Look what happens.
That. So we got Bloody Moon. Then we're going to talk about a really sleazy little flick that Severin put out that I think is, again, another movie a lot of people have been waiting for a long time, and that's Last House on the Beach.
Oh, yeah.
And then, in honor of the October show, Cinema Wasteland, which you and I both attend,
mm-hmm.
We love. Fred, the Hammer Williamson, is going to be there. So, we're going to review and talk about Inglourious Basterds.
See, I'm glad you did the voice there, because I thought for some reason I needed to do the voice, but you totally took the pressure off me, so I feel better now. Thank you.
There you go. Awesome. What can I say? I try to anticipate my co-host needs and help them out. So, we got some reviews. We've got a conversation with David Gregory. We got a lot of stuff for you.
Jam-packed.
Jam-packed. Damn sure. Being this is a bonus episode, though, we won't have our normal segments, but those segments will return in some form or another, and then in the future, the immediate future, the next show, we'll have some segments. And also, before we jump back into the show, keep an eye on the website, because there's an exciting bit of show business. There's an exciting bit of business regarding the Gut Munchers podcast and an interview, which I will not announce now because they don't have it in the can, but it's all but guaranteed to happen, and it will be somebody that most people will recognize. So it's a big interview coming up. But we already have a big interview for you right now, and that's David Gregory. So tell you what, Ed, why don't we go ahead and do the David Gregory interview, and after that we'll take a break and come back, and we'll jump into some Severin titles. What do you think?
Sounds peachy keen to me.
Same here. All right, guys. We'll be right back on the Gut Munchers podcast. When we get back, you'll be hearing David Gregory.
The legend of Frankenstein once again brings terror and nightmare to the screen in Lady Frankenstein. Joseph Cotten is Baron Frankenstein.
But his face.
Devil with his face. I don't care what he looks like. I want him to live.
Sarah Bay is Lady Frankenstein.
That is what they call your father's life's work, a monster, and they're right.
They are not right.
She's beautiful, she's evil, and she'll do anything for love.
Would you like to have my body bend to you? Would you like to make love to me?
She creates a new, more terrifying monster, and only the monster she creates can satisfy her strange desires. Using her beauty and her scalpel, she cuts deeply into men's hearts.
Yes, you're right. Kill it.
There has never been a movie like Lady Frankenstein. Rated R.
Actually, the funny thing is I always like to ask the very very same question every time I talk to somebody. The first one out the gate is, what inspired you to be a filmmaker? What was that initial motivation to pick up a camera?
I had always been a movie fan since I was very young. I was one of those filmmakers whose first movie experience was seeing King Kong. And that obviously made quite an impression on me when I was about four. Funnily enough, the first version of King Kong I saw was the 1976 version, not the 1933. But it still made a big impression on me. And I think I saw the 1933 version a few days later because it was on TV or something like that. And anyway, at that point, I became obsessed with monsters and dinosaurs and whatever. And from then on, I just got really into horror and vampires. And then when I was old enough to watch movies on TV, I would watch all the Hammer movies. And when video came in, I'd watch all the nasty European movies. And so I was just obsessed with movies, and particularly horror movies, from a very young age. And I got a Super 8 camera when I was really quite young. Actually, my parents had an 8mm camera, so I think the first short films I was making were just on 8mm. And so I think, you know, with school friends and stuff, the old story, we'd be in the back garden chopping each other up and pulling our guts out and stuff like that. So I was always making films as a kid. And then I went to film school in Boston and made a few films there. My thesis film, Scape, which is on the Playtown Blu-ray in Boston. And then after that, just got into the making of documentaries, kind of by mistake, and eventually just wanted to go back to the initial goal of wanting to make narrative films, and Playtown is the first feature to come out of that.
Excellent. And actually, I'm going to talk to you about Playtown here, but then I do have some questions about the documentaries that you worked on. But let's talk about Plague Town. Where did the idea? I know that you're also not only the director, but you're also one of the co-writers. Where did this idea come for this movie, and what inspired you to?
It was while I was still living in England after college. I had a very scary babysitting experience that involved a child that kind of freaked out because I wouldn't give him a beer. And he was like a six-year-old kid, and he freaked out and started banging his head against the window and just generally being a very scary child. And at that point, that was the first experience I'd had where I actually saw how, you know, uncontrollable kind of a kid who's really hyperactive can be, and it's a very frightening thing because you just don't know what to do. And I wrote a short film sort of based on that experience, called Come Out and Play, but I never actually made the short film because right after that that was after I'd made Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Shocking Truth, but it was before I'd moved to the US to be doing the making of in earnest. So that never got made, but while I was working at Blue Underground with John Cregan, we were doing a lot of editing together there on the featurettes and documentaries. And he also is a film school grad and wanted to get into making feature films. And I showed him the short, and he said, well, let's develop it into a feature, and that's what we did.
Great. And I have to ask this question because the character design of the kids, there's a couple of certain of the characters, the kid with the jowls and the one the one girl with the eyes that I guess are painted on a blindfold or...
Rosemary.
Were these characters that you had envisioned in your mind's eye when you're writing the script? And then how well did that go from what you saw to what you actually got on camera?
Those two kids in the film are the two that came out exactly as I imagined them, as they were described in the script. And, particularly Rosemary, because I wanted kind of this haunting beauty to the lead villain. I didn't, obviously mostly in horror movies, the lead villain is kind of a brutish, ugly, weapon-wielding man in general. So the fact that this was an early teenage girl who was actually really rather elegant was something that I thought would be interesting and haunting and creepy. And Jowls is probably the ugliest of the Plague Kids. And Tate Steinsick, the special effects artist, went through many drafts of that makeup because I said to him, like, I wanted it to be like testicles hanging from her chin. And so every time he did it, it just didn't wobble enough. And when she's hitting the mother with the hubcap, I wanted this kind of like just bizarre wobble because I wanted it to be slightly amusing when she's actually doing this really kind of violent act. And so that came out exactly as I wanted. But Tate and I went through, we worked together a lot on getting the look of the kids right because I still wanted them to be childlike and, in some cases vaguely angelic, even though they were ugly and wrong and hadn't come out right. And obviously, very violent, but they're just kids who are doing what they think is a fun thing for kids to do. And so I wanted that kind of childlike essence to them, even though they were doing stuff that really, really they should have been punished for.
Yeah, and actually, since you mentioned it, special effects wise, and also that one scene, when you wrote the scene with Jowls and the mother and the hubcap there, or the stepmom, mm-hmm. did you envision it being as powerful as it turned out? Because that's probably that and any of the scenes with Rosemary are the most memorable to me. Did you know that was going to turn out like that? And how hard was that to shoot?
That was the death that I wanted to be the most brutal, because she's kind of the most sympathetic character of the five leads. She's the one who really has done nothing wrong and hasn't been bickering with people and just generally being annoying. And so for her, I wanted, she was kind of the grandmother, and you know, I really wanted that death to be the one that really kind of, you would say, oh my God, that's not right. Oh no, she's being hit again. Oh no, that's not right. But even after that, she gets to have like a brief heroic moment where she saves Molly, the lead daughter. And so yeah, that was very definitely intentional. I wanted that to be something that, you know, where every time there was a hit, one more hit comes, and you can't quite, hopefully you can't quite believe that she could be hit in the face any more time.
Yeah, and now, while that might be the most brutal, I don't know if, and again, I'm a lot of people have seen this movie already, and I'm hoping to turn some other people onto it who maybe haven't seen the movie. But I also thought it was rather amusing, not even maybe comedic, but the amount of torture you put the boyfriend through, the amount of
and you're right in saying that, is that by amusing, I don't want it to be kind of necessarily laugh out loud funny, although there are kind of some bizarre chuckles in that. But yes, the boyfriend, the English guy, it was something that we really wanted to stretch the limit on how much torture you can put one character through in a movie. And, you know, because usually in these films, it's the lead girl who literally has to endure everything and then kind of breaks through the window and runs out into the sun to survive. But this guy, we had designed him in such a way that he was the most despicable form of English youth that you can possibly imagine, which very much do exist. I mean, there's a lot of people who are kind of like this guy with this really superior British attitude, and a lot of kind of anti-American sentiments, and I'm just so much smarter and well-traveled than you are. And it's just really annoying sometimes to hear that stuff, that somebody's so cocksure of themselves. And so I wanted him to be just like somebody about halfway through the movie, you think like you could never, ever have any sympathy for this guy. But by the end of the movie, because he's been put through so much stuff that that you may think, maybe he didn't deserve quite that, but we really wanted to stretch it to the limit.
And I want to talk a little bit about maybe some of the challenges you had making the movie. First of all, I have to say, I was absolutely shocked after getting done watching the movie for the first time. I never would have thought that was shot in the States. How the heck did you pull that off? And how hard was it to find those locations for where you shot to make them look like they were in, I believe you had it set in Ireland.
That's right. Originally, we had written it to be set in Ireland, and I had actually been over and location scouted in Ireland, taken a lot of photos, and we came up with a budget, and it was just too expensive to shoot it in Ireland, and which was a shame because it was perfect, and I really wanted it to be that kind of green, sodden, melancholy... melancholy kind of atmosphere over the whole thing. And so when we figured out that we couldn't shoot it in Ireland, you know, we went through this whole dilemma stage where we were trying to figure out, you know, can we set it, where else can we set it that's going to be cheaper? And then it just so happened that a friend of mine, Daryl Tucker, who had produced and shot Scathed, my thesis film, he and I got back in touch, and he started sending me photos of from all around Connecticut, and I'd sent him the photos that I'd taken in Ireland, and basically a lot of it was looking very similar. So I flew out to Connecticut, and it was a perfect weekend where it was completely overcast and raining, and he just took me all over the place, showed me all the stone walls and stone buildings and really kind of sodden fields. And I said, I think we can do it here, you know. And so that's what we did, and we rebudgeted it. And what we probably didn't take into account was that, you know, not all of Connecticut looks like that. Connecticut's actually, you know, full of lots of big houses and it's very, you know, shortcut grass and things like that. So we actually had to go all over the state in the 21 days that we shot in order to kind of get those locations that looked exactly as I wanted them to.
In addition to the location challenges, you shot this movie at night, a big chunk of it. And what kind of interesting or what kind of challenges did that present? As well as you had not only were shooting at night, but you were shooting at night with a fairly large cast of kids and children.
Yeah, and lots of practical effects, and we were shooting on film. And like I say, we were all over the state, and we had a very tight schedule and a relatively low budget. So yeah, it caused an enormous amount of challenges. But the fact was, everybody who was there—it's a bit of a cliche—but everybody who was there was really determined to make it as good as it could be, because you know, the cast and the crew were really just into it, and the with the kids. A lot of the kids were teenagers, so they weren't, you know, really young kids, although there were a few 6- and 7-year-olds. But what was cool about that was that, they, contrary to the way the kids are depicted in the movie as evil little buggers, they were actually all also really into it and had no problem, you know, doing what they were told and acting as they needed to act. And I think that was because we were shooting in Connecticut as opposed to L.A., where you would have star children and star children's parents around just causing trouble the whole time and, you know, crazy union rules and stuff like that. But in this situation, it was more like Halloween for them, where they got to go out on a weekend late at night, dress up in Halloween costumes and, you know, beat up adults. So I think it was very exciting for them. It was very exciting for the parents to be involved in what they saw as a real, you know, I wouldn't say a big movie, but you know, a proper production. So so that whole thing was actually not a problem at all.
Great. And you had also mentioned the cast. I had another question here to ask you about that. Did it take long to assemble the cast for the movie? Because they were all really just perfect. They were all great.
Yeah, we did a lot of auditions here in New York City for the lead roles. And because it was a non-union movie, you know, I couldn't do it based on people's reels and things like that. We had to do a lot of readings and a lot of callbacks and stuff like that to get the right people to play the leads. And I think, you know, when Erica Rhodes and Jocelyn DeCosta and Lindsay Gorenson and David Lombard, when they came in, you know, it seemed pretty clear that they were going to be the ones, although we still did an enormous amount of callbacks for the two lead girls, because I really struggled over the fact that how can they be sisters, because they actually look quite different from each other. But at the end of the day, they were both just so good. You know, I justified it by the fact that you never actually see the mother. And, you know, who knows, one of them could be adopted. It doesn't really matter. And they worked really well together and ended up really coming through for the movie, because they too were also really extremely dedicated to it. Like, neither of them were horror fans in any way, or, you know, had any desire to be screen queens or anything like that. But they really liked it. They really liked their characters, and they just absolutely threw themselves into it wholeheartedly. And James, who plays the English guy, I was pretty, I would say I was absolutely adamant that we have an actual English person play that role, because I have a bit of a pet peeve about people who do other accents in movies. Like, I think Tim Roth is terrible in Reservoir Dogs, for example, when he's doing an American accent. So a lot of people came in to audition for that role because they had, you know, a grandmother who was English or something like that. And it just, we went through just, it seems like hundreds of people who actually just couldn't get it right. So it was towards the end of auditioning when James actually came in, and when he introduced himself, and he was actually from Leicester, which is not far from where I'm from in Nottingham, I was like, oh, thank God, and please let him be able to act. And luckily he was, so it worked out. But yeah, I was extremely happy with all the leads. We rehearsed for a long time, and they, you know, we had to go through a little process, because I wanted to make sure a lot of the line deliveries were kind of deadpan as opposed to over the top and naturalistic and that kind of thing. So we really worked hard on trying to get it exactly as we wanted.
Fantastic. And I guess the last question I have about, and it's not even so much about the movie itself, but what's next for you as a director? What's your next project? Do you have one yet?
Before we move on to that, yeah, I need to also talk about the girl who played Rosemary, because she was also particularly good.
Okay.
Kate Aspinwall. She was actually cast out of Connecticut along with the other kids, and she was just a 13-year-old girl who came in and just looked fantastic, and she'd done a bit of modeling before. And, you know, I just sat and interviewed her about would she have a problem with being kind of like the lead villain and having to do nasty things to people. And she's like, no, I'll be fine. And then we had to have this whole discussion about whether it was actually appropriate to have a 13-year-old girl play this role, you know, which involves kind of her grandmother offering her up to the English guy. And we were like, you know, she's so perfect for the role that we have to cast her. And that was definitely the case, because she actually had a kind of mind movement going on when she did it, because she's blind.
Yeah.
And, you know, she couldn't see through that blindfold. And she has no lines or anything like that, but I think she came across, you know, with her performance in addition to the way she looked, exactly how I wanted it to do, because I wanted this kind of ballerina type elegance to her, even when she's, you know, poking somebody's eyes out.
And she actually does have the movement of the character is something that sticks with you. That's pretty much the, and like I didn't even remember. Well, I kind of remember, but she has no lines, but she's a very memorable character nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I hope that came across.
definitely did. So, but as this, because I'll tell you right now, I'm a huge fan of the movie. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you. Did you see it in Philadelphia?
I actually didn't get to see it in Philadelphia, but what they did is they sent me. I covered the film festival, so they had sent me a screener of just. The film, and I covered it for the Philly Film Fest, and then. I got a chance to check out the DVD when it came out with all the special features and everything. So, but yeah, I got cool. to catch it pretty early on, and I was definitely making a lot of racket when I saw it was coming out in DVD that people needed to check it out. I'm a huge fan of the film.
Oh, thanks, man. That's great.
So, but has this and I'm actually so excited about the movie. What's your next project? Do you have one lined up yet?
Yeah, well, I've written a script called Little Polly Does Bad Things, and but it's not close to going into production yet. It's still at the first draft stage of the script, so we'll see what happens with that. And I've also written a script for a chapter of an anthology film, which is something that I want to try and put together with a handful of different horror directors. But neither of them are close to actually going into production. I'm kind of concentrating on doing the Severin work at the moment, which I kind of neglected for a year and a half while I was making Playtime.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the documentary work that you've done. I was in preparation for this. I was going through your IMDb page, and you have done an incredible amount of documentaries or special features for DVDs.
Yeah.
A lot of which are some of my favorite ones, and I'm just going to mention a few, then ask you a question or two. But you've done a couple of Savini things with, I think you did one, Two Evil Eyes and Death Dream.
That's right, yeah.
And you did probably one of my favorite special features that I've seen in a long time was the Stan Winston effects for Dead and Buried.
Oh, yeah, that one came. Yeah, I was really happy with that one. Stan Winston was a fantastic interviewee.
And then one of my favorite actors is Joe Spinell, and you did a marvelous special feature for Maniac called, I think, The Joe Spinell Story.
The Joe Spinell Story, yeah. And that's definitely one of my favorites. And, of course, I was working with Bill Lustig at the time, and it came about because it was quite early on when I was doing featurettes for Anchor Bay, and I said, well, obviously we're putting out Maniac. We've got to do a making of Maniac. You know, you're right here. And Bill wasn't really into that idea, but he was into the idea of doing a documentary on Joe Spinell, because he was somebody that was really a character, somebody who was really loved, and just had so many weird and colorful stories about his life. And he was going to fall into obscurity. And Bill said, you know, we need to do a tribute to Joe. And so that's how that came about. And luckily, as Bill was the executive producer, it gave us a lot more leeway and time and ability to get a wide array of interviewees and footage and stuff like that to actually make it kind of a fully-fledged bio documentary. So, and sure enough, you know, with every person that I interviewed, there was some crazy new story about this guy and his antics. So it was really something. But it's not, you know, what comes out in the documentary, hopefully, it's not just about some crazy whack job. I mean, this guy was really loved and really passionate about acting and people. So, you know, that kind of tightrope that he was walking with his life was, I think, what made it interesting.
Yeah, and actually I was going to mention that when you were saying it. It's like all these wonderful, crazy stories, but everybody telling them obviously had, like you said, some love for the guy. The guy was...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, real passion for him and real vivid memories of this guy who died, you know, quite a while back.
Now, you've done a lot of these, and I really incredible amount of these. Do you have maybe a favorite person that you've met from this, a favorite interview? And then of all of them that you've done, do you have a personal favorite that you had the most either fun with or you're most proud of?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the one that I'm most proud of, I think probably the Ban the Sadist videos are the one, that's a two-part piece that we did about the Video Nasty scandal in England. And that we had Anchor Bay UK behind us, and they gave us, you know, they gave us some budget to actually go and get a bunch of BBC footage and stuff like that. So we were able to actually, you know, listen to all these uptight English politicians talking about, you know, killer driller and getting the names wrong and stuff like this. And it was absolutely jaw-dropping that this thing happened, such that, you know, some people even went to jail. A lot of people were driven out of business just so they could ban things like The Evil Dead, because a bunch of politicians and right-wing newspapers just wanted to make a big deal about all this filth and violence that was entering our homes at the beginning of the video era. So unfortunately, that's not available in the US because it's, you know, we only got the clearances for that footage in the UK. So we're unable to even bring that out on our own label. But, you know, if people ask me which one would you watch, I would suggest watching Ban the Sadist videos parts 1 and 2. I'm also very happy with The Godfathers of Mondo, the one I did on for the Mondo Carne box set with Jack Petty and Prosperi. I'm still fond of the first one, Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the Shocking Truth.
Great.
What else? I don't know. There's quite a lot of them that I'm really quite happy with, because when you're doing these things retrospectively, the fact that people are there to talk to you and giving their time to talk to you, they're there because they do have recollections or fondness or something to say about the production that they were involved with. So it does, then a story can come out about a particular production. I'm pretty happy with the Left House on the Left one as well that we did initially for the UK, but it's just come out in the US on the latest MGM release of Left House on the Left.
That's another one. And I love that one.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so, I mean, you've seen it. That's very cool. And as far as people, I mean, there's been, it's, you know, if you'd have asked me when I was in high school or whatever, what the dream job would be to meet all these kind of heroes and who make movies, that would have probably been what I would say. And so I've been very fortunate to have been able to talk to these people about the old movies that they made, the ones that I'm really passionate about. And but specifically, people that spring to mind, I always enjoy interviewing Jess Franco. Like, whether you like his movies or not, he's a very interesting guy. He's accomplished an amazing amount in his career, and he has absolutely no inhibitions about what he's going to say about the movie, whether he loves it or hates it. Actually, he'll never say he loves one of his movies, but he will often say he hates one of his movies. You know, or about the people, if he thought they were stupid or inept, or if they were great. And so, but he's just such a colorful character and has such vivid memories for a guy who's made 200 movies or whatever it is. The fact that he can reminisce about a specific movie from 1982 that he probably made in a few days between three other movies. Roman Polanski was particularly was a particularly impressive person to meet because he's somebody that I've always admired, and you know, you get a bit apprehensive about meeting an absolute hero, but that they're not actually going to live up to your expectations. But he did, and he surpassed them, and he was certainly charming and amazing and full of insight, and was just full of energy. A man in his 70s, just sat for 2 hours talking about Knife in the Water, Repulsion, and Cul-de-Sac. And so that was a particularly impressive encounter. Who else would I say? I don't know. I've interviewed a lot of people, but there's very few where I walk away from it saying, yeah, that person was stupid or that person was an asshole.
I'm glad you had that to say about Jess Franco, though, because I'm not going to lie. I've actually double-dipped on a couple of releases just for the Jess Franco interview because
it is basically something that's sometimes as interesting as the film, or more so in the case of Devil Hunter or the Cannibals. So it's basically worth watching Jess Franco and listening to him for 20 minutes, and it actually gives you an appreciation of a film that before you thought had no redeeming value whatsoever. So it's always worth picking up a Franco interview.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny because I'm a bigger fan of Jess Franco after watching his the special features and hearing him talk than I was before. So that's always a good thing.
Yeah, if you ever get the chance to meet him for any reason, I mean, I highly recommend it because he's just such a character. He's an excellent person to hang out with. Him and he's still married to Lena Romay. And
so I guess the other and I'm not really pulling your chain here. When I was looking through the special features you've done, I'm one of those guys. When he buys a DVD, I watch the movie and the special features on every DVD that I buy. And you've done a ton of wonderful special features, just blow me away as I'm clicking. I love that one. I love this one. And I have to ask.
No, thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I mean, they're really great. And I have to ask, and you kind of already mentioned this dream job thing, but as a fan, this has got to be a blast to do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, particularly when I first started doing it, and there were just, it was Anchor Bay, there were just so many different films that they had coming up that we could just sit and have a meeting and decide which one was worthy of a documentary. And, you know, To the Devil, the Daughter, the last Hammer horror film, got to make a documentary about the collapse of Hammer, you know, that kind of thing. And so, and I would be traveling all around the place and working on several of them at the same time and just gathering interviews for several different featurettes because, you know, you're working around people's schedules and stuff like that. So a lot of them would take a long time to actually get in the can and then get edited. So I would always be working on several at the same time. I remember one summer, I think it was the summer of 2001, I was working on, we had four editors in the underground office, and we were working on Suspiria, Heathers, the Joe Spinell story, the Emmanuel trilogy, and like three others all at the same time, 24 hours a day. We had two separate shifts with four editors just putting these things together. But it was great because, you know, you got to tell the story of the making of these films, which, you know, back then EPKs were not so common. And I don't like EPKs nearly as much as featurettes anyway, because EPKs are obviously just adverts. But but with the benefit of hindsight, you generally tend to get people being kind of honest and telling more kind of anecdotal experiences from the making of the film rather than the sort of puff piece stuff where they talk about how wonderful everybody was.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to move on a little bit and talk about your work at Severin, who's one of the companies that I absolutely love what you guys do. We'll talk a little bit about your role there and how you got involved. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I was working at Blue Underground for the first 5 years of its existence. And Blue Underground started to kind of slow down a little bit in the amount of titles that they were putting out. So it was at that point that me, John Cregan, who co-wrote Playtown with me, and Carl Duff, my business partner in London, decided that we'd form our own label, which became Severin Films, and that was in 2006. And since then, we've released something like 60 films on DVD, and we're just starting our Blu-rays now with Inglourious Basterds this month.
Yep. And how are you involved, or do you help track down the titles or decide what titles you guys try to put out?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's just the three of us. Actually, there's now four of us. We just took on Evan Husney, who used to work for Troma, and he put together that cool Combat Shop and Last Horror Film disc that came out quite recently. So he seemed like a good fit for the team. But yeah, it's between the three of us, we decide which movies we want to track down and which ones it's not worth it. And it's evolved a little since we first started, because initially we were doing a lot of kind of Euro erotic weird stuff. And that was all. And then I think The Psychic was the first kind of straight ahead, horror thriller that we put out. And that kind of opened the door so we could really do anything we liked and anything that came to us that we thought made sense. You know, which encompasses everything from The Simple Dwarf to The Hairdresser's Husband. And there's a lot in between those two movies.
Yeah.
They came out one month after another, so it really kind of showed how wide we like to cast the net these days.
You there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sorry, I lost you there for just a second. But, yeah, actually, and I got to ask... Well, first of all, I just want to say whoever's idea it was to give Nightmare Castle that kind of treatment and to get such a great interview with Barbara Steele, huge pat on the back. It's one of my favorite movies, and I never thought I'd see a special edition.
Well, that's good to hear, because it was a bit of a risk, because as you know, it's been out probably over 100 times on DVD already in various... you know, dodgy bootlegs that all from wildly varying quality sources, but none of them particularly good. And you're right, it is a really good film. And we did happen across the company that actually owned it, which was a surprise, because why would they not stop all these illegal versions? But I guess they just didn't think it was worth chasing after all these fly-by-night companies who were just stealing films, basically. And we tracked down the original negative, and we were able to take a look at it, and it was in fantastic condition, and it was actually a beautifully shot movie, which you would never be able to tell from the bootleg versions that had been out. And we thought, well, let's roll the dice. If it's worth, if the fans are really dedicated to you know, horror movies, then they will throw away their three bootleg versions that they have in their collection. They will buy this version because this version is finally the way it's supposed to look. And so it was a roll of the dice, because we didn't know if people were going to do that, particularly in the current DVD climate where people's shelves are really overstuffed with films that they've bought two and three times. But we just thought it was worth it because it was a good enough film and the element was good enough. And then we approached Mario Chiano, the director. He was happy about the fact that it was finally coming out and going to look the right way. And then we approached Barbara Steele. And I'd already approached Barbara Steele probably a couple of times before and hadn't really heard anything back. But I did get her to do the commentary for The She-Beast, the Michael Reeves movie. Mm-hmm. And I think she only did that because she was friends with Paul Maslansky, the producer. But she actually almost didn't do that on the day, because she made the mistake of actually watching the movie the night before and just thought it was god-awful. But then she thought, oh, well, I've committed to it, so I'll go along. But after meeting her that first time, I approached her about Nightmare Castle, and you know, she made a lot of these gothic horror movies all around the same time, so she was a little reluctant about whether or not she'd have anything really specific to say about the making of Nightmare Castle. So I just said, well, let's do a career interview, you know. And so I sent her a bunch of questions, and she liked the questions, and we met, and she was comfortable with it, because she doesn't give many interviews at all, particularly horror-related interviews, and we got along, and so we we sat down for a little while and did that interview, and I thought she was great. I thought she was charming, and we've actually stayed friends since.
Excellent. So I have to ask, and this is probably a terrible.
And actually, she just watched Playtown the other day for the first time, and she really, really liked it. So I was quite happy about that.
Excellent. It's always nice to hear the people that you're fans of. They turn out to be good, nice people, like Jess Franco and Barbara Steele. And,
yeah.
You know, it's always nice to realize that they're actually really nice people. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So I got to ask you the question, and it's probably you could you don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But do you have a favorite movie out of the Severin catalog?
Ooh, that's a good question. Out of the Severin catalog, my favorite movie. Shit, I hate to say it, but my favorite movie from the Severin catalog is The Hairdresser's Husband. But but as far as like the culty stuff goes, it's probably Inglourious Basterds.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, and I'm pretty fond of Screwballs as well, which is the one we're bringing out next month, which is kind of a Canadian Porky's ripoff. But I saw that when I was a young impressionable high school lad, so I was quite fond of that, and I was very glad to get that. Which was the same reason we got Bloody Moon. Actually, it was one of the first horror movies I ever rented, and it made a massive impression on me. You know, the buzzsaw decapitation, I just thought was the best thing I had ever seen. So it was absolute movie magic, better than anything in Star Wars. So when we were, and then it got banned in England, of course, as one of the Video Nasty. So it was unavailable to me for a while. So I just had this kind of memory of it from when I saw it when I was like 9 years old. So it was really nice to be able to kind of restore that in high definition and bring that out on DVD. It's not quite as good a movie as I remembered it then, but it's still pretty cool.
Well, it is, and I was actually, I have, I think, five movies written down that are ones that jumped out of your catalog that I love, which is Inglourious Basterds, Nightmare Castle, Last House on the Beach.
It's a cool movie.
Yeah, Sinful Dwarf, and actually Bloody Moon's on this list. I love that movie. That was such a
All right.
It was such a revelation for me. I had never seen it, and I was kind of like, yeah, we'll see what it is. And like you say, that the buzzsaw just it had me there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it doesn't make such an impression now. It's obviously a mannequin, but when I saw it when I was 9 or whatever, I'd never seen anything like that. So it made quite an indentation on my brain. You know, I get a Simple Dwarf. I'm really happy we put out because, I mean, it really has got to be one of the sleaziest films ever made. And it's just unbelievable that it ever did get made because, you know, just scrape beneath the grimy surface. And, you know, there's some weird artistry in that film, all the toys and that title mm-hmm. sequence and, you know, the mother who sings show tunes and stuff like that. They obviously put some thought into it. They weren't just making a shocking softcore movie. The fact that another company, Something Weird, were going to put it out a few years ago, and their distributor, Image Entertainment, took one look at it and said, there's absolutely no way we're going near this. But it was fun for us to be able to kind of walk in and say, well, we have no such scruples, and and I know Something Weird don't either, but it was, but Image certainly did. And so we were happy to get the internegative of that and do a nice, new, beautiful, in quotes, transfer.
it's such an odd little movie, and again, if anybody hasn't listening to this has not seen these movies, these are all great movies, and The Sinful Dwarf is just one of those movies where I describe it and people look at me funny. I'm like, you got to watch it, and then they watch it and they go, I get it. I don't know why I like it, but I like it.
Yeah, exactly. And then in September we've got Hardware coming out, which is a relatively big movie for us because it was a Miramax release when it first came out. It was Richard Stanley's first feature. And we have such a smorgasbord of extras for that film, and the new high-def transfer looks amazing. And so that's going to be a pretty incredible DVD, and we're working on that with Norman Hill, who used to be with Subversive Cinema that did the Dust Devil set. So you know it's going to be in good hands.
Oh yeah, and you made, trust me, you made a lot of people happy when you guys got that one. A lot of people. It's funny, it's a short, very short list for genre fans of movies now that we haven't seen on DVD. And that was near the top of the list. That was incredible to hear that was coming out.
Yeah. No, it took a while to get it because obviously we were dealing with a major studio to get it. But mm-hmm. But they had no interest in it, so it was we were able to pry it away from them, which was nice.
And that actually leads into my next and actually close to my last question here. What's been the hardest movie to get, and maybe the most rewarding movie to get to put out?
I think the one that we spent the most time on tracking the rights down to was Deathstream when I was at Blindabound, because it was a film that Carl and I had put out in England on our label Exploited, but somehow nobody seemed to know who owned it for the US. And so it had been kind of orphaned, but not even come out on bootlegs or anything like that. It had been out in the early days of VHS. And I just spent forever trying to track people down who may know who was the owner of Deathstream. And luckily we were able to do it, because I think it's a phenomenal film. I actually love all the films that Bob Clark and Alan Ormsby did in the 70s. I think they were really, really unique, and I think they're kind of unsung, whereas really they should be kind of in the same level of appreciation as you know, the Romeros and the Argentos and that lot. They just didn't kind of continue it, so they kind of fell into obscurity as far as the horror movies they did, but the ones that they did were really impressive.
Well, and I actually have those in my collection, so I wholeheartedly agree with you.
Good. Alan Ormsby was actually the first person who read the play transcript and gave me the some very useful feedback on the screenplay, so that's why his name's in the special thanks.
Cool. Outstanding. Well, I want to thank you very much for spending this much of your time with us here. Is there anything else you would like to say before we go?
No, just I hope people enjoy Plague It Town. It's definitely a polarizing horror movie, so people that really like it, I really appreciate it. And I hope that people continue to keep their eye on what Severin Films is doing, because we're working around the clock to put out as good editions of these films as we can. We just released Fulci's last film, Door Into Silence. We've got Inglourious Basterds and Eagles Over London this month, and Scribbles next month, then Hardware, and then there's another really sleazy little number called Hannah D, the girl from Vondelpark, from the director of Werewolf Woman and Supported Women of the SF Special Section. So, believe me, that film is has to be seen to be believed.
And we're back on the Gut Munchers podcast. I am John, and with me again is Ed. Before we go any further, I want to thank David Gregory for stopping by and doing that wonderful interview with us. He's a really cool guy, and I know that Plague Town has gotten some mixed reviews, but you know what? It's a pretty decent movie. And I know you've seen it, Ed, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, just kind of roughly, what do you think?
See, you know, I guess it's a good comparison, because you say about it getting some rough reviews, and I'd say that's kind of what mine was. I didn't think the movie was terrible, but I didn't really, I don't know, it didn't do a whole lot for me. I think the reason why is because, you know, not too long before I saw the movie, I saw a movie called Them that Dark Sky put out, and I thought Them was just a lot more effective, and they're the same kind of movie, I guess you could say. Like, they're different movies, but you know, like the basic, you know, blah or whatever you have, you know, the basic storyline or whatever is very, very similar. So I just didn't think it was that great. I think it's an okay film. I think it's been done better elsewhere. You know, another movie that I thought was real similar to it was, have you ever seen Wicked Little Things? It's one of the After Dark movies from the first year that they had the Horror Fest.
Yes.
Yeah, very similar, even though that movie is surely with zombie children. A lot of the stuff and a lot of the you know, like the scares and some of the stuff they did, I thought they were very similar. But it's not a bad movie. I just thought there was some poor pacing, and I didn't really care for too many of the characters. Not many likable or interesting characters, you know. It was just kind of watered down to me, you know what I mean? But, I mean, I know it's kind of hit and miss with people. I've noticed that. Either people really seem to enjoy it or people are kind of lukewarm on it.
Well, and I fall in that category of people that really enjoyed it. And I think after listening to the interview, people know what I like. But basically, just to give my brief opinion of it, I gave it a solid 3 stars. And there's a written review for it up on the Gutmuchers website. I really dug it. I dig Evil Kid movies, so I'm inclined to like that sort of thing to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't disagree with you and everything you said, even though I did find Ills to have a lot more tension, but at the same time, maybe be a little more slower than this one. I thought there was a pretty good pacing for kills, and I don't think anything in Ills was quite as brutal as the mom biting it to the hubcap. That scene just sticks with me. And I don't know if you remember the stepmother being beaten to death with a hubcap.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's definitely, you know how I compared it with Them.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a version of Them that has a lot more violence in it, I will say that.
Yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, that was just our little mini review discussion for Plague Town. I liked it. You weren't so hot on it, but that's not unusual. There's a lot of people that aren't very hot on it, and there's some people that like it as much as I do. I'm a fan, and I, you know, it is what it is.
You know what? I will say this, though, just to end, like to say something positive about the movie, is the movie's pretty simple. You know, it's not a horribly overcomplicated storyline. It's a simple, straightforward story. And that's something that I thought was refreshing about the movie, though. I will say that. It didn't find the need to be overly complicated or pretentious. It just is what it is.
True. And if I have one last thing I'll say about it is, and this is my, you know, if you read my reviews, you watch the YouTube, and you listen to the show, you'll know one of the things I hate the most is whenever something violent or bad's about to happen, for the camera to start shaking like it's a 12-year-old off his Ritalin.
Yeah.
And this movie doesn't do it. It's shot on film, and it shows you what's going to show you, and I appreciate that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I do, too. I will say that. I'll agree completely.
But let's talk about some Severin titles.
Oh, let's do it.
Let's talk with – why don't we start off with what might be the sleaziest title of the show?
Absolutely.
So I'm going to let you do a plot synopsis for –
Last House on the Beach.
All right, go for it.
Okay, let me give you a real quick explanation here of what the movie is. First off, too, you know, everybody's aware of Last House on the Left, okay? It's one of the greatest exploitation movies of all time, and it might be the most influential. Something I'm sure people have heard me say on the show before is I'm a fan of Last House ripoffs. That's exactly what Last House on the Beach is. It's a Last House ripoff, but it's a damn good one. It's basically the story of a group of bank robbers who are on the run from police. In the middle of their escape, I guess, they end up on an, like, where there's this island home where these young women are at studying for exams. The criminals decide it's the perfect place to go and hold up, you know, while the heat's on, if you will. And of course, that leads to them having some women to terrorize while they're at it. It's a basic good versus evil story, and a survival movie for the women, basically. But it's as mean-spirited and sadistic as you could possibly want it to be. And something extremely interesting to me about this film is it's directed by a guy named Franco Prosperi, who's one half of the people who made the Mondo Cane films. This movie's not a Mondo film by any stretch of the means. It's actually a movie with narrative and whatnot as a story and, you know, what you'd expect from it. But I think that's something very interesting from it, and it's certainly a nice, sleazy piece of exploitation.
I agree. Now, I'm going to start the discussion off.
Okay.
And I'm going to say, and I'm going to put something out there, and you can agree or disagree with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a huge... It's weird to say you're a fan of Last House on the Left, but I am.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very powerful movie.
Absolutely.
I don't find that movie to be sleazy. I find that movie to be very... See, for me, the difference is Last House on the Left, you know, the rapes and the murders, they're done in such a realistic way, hyper-realistic way, at least for the time, that there's a power to them. There's a, like, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm watching this sort of to it, where it's, to me, it actually carries like it creates an emotional response out of me. I also would say the same thing about the rape scene in I Spit on Your Grave. Mm-hmm. There's this just brutality to it. And but it doesn't have a – I guess maybe there's not as much of a cinematic feel to it. It's almost like you're standing there watching it happen.
Yeah.
I'm watching Last House on the Beach.
Mm-hmm.
It has a sleazy feel to it because I know I'm watching a movie. And there's some brutal stuff in it. And it doesn't make it any worse. Or it doesn't – like one's not better than the other. It's a different feel. And, you know, I'd actually – it's much easier to watch – Last House on the Beach than it is to watch Last House on the Left, because Last House on the Beach has a very it's got a polished cinematic feel to it. It is a knockoff, a ripoff. It does follow that same kind of formula. And again, like I totally agree with you. When I say something's a ripoff of something else, if you do it well, who the hell cares?
Absolutely.
You know, it's like, well, that's just a ripoff of a Friday the 13th movie. But they did a good job, and it entertained me. So what's the point of a movie but to entertain you? I think Last House on the Beach is very entertaining and very fun. And, yeah, it's a knockoff. But, you know, you throw the additional. And, of course, it's Last House on the Left with a touch of nunsploitation.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
What Ed didn't tell you is the girls, and I don't think you mentioned this, but the girls are from a private school. And the one older lady that's with them that's a hot older chick is a nun. And as soon as the criminals find out she's a nun, they do some rather naughty things that a nun shouldn't be doing. And then, of course, the payoff scene at the end. And I don't mean the payoff at the very end where the tables get turned, but I mean the payoff scene that kind of pushes the hostages over the edge. You don't see it, but you know what's going on, and it's fucking brutal as hell.
Yeah, and that's another thing, too, about this movie that, you know, since you mentioned the nunsploitation part, I mean, there's a scene specifically in the movie where a woman gets completely humiliated in full nun garb that will offend people. You know what I mean? And that's the thing. That's what, you know, how I said earlier about Franco Prosperi as being the director of this one. This is a guy that's made a career off of offending and pissing people off. I mean, if you guys listen to our Blue Underground show, it's kind of funny, actually, you know, when I go back and re-listen to that, because we're all in, like, this mood about these films, and we're trying to tell you guys the ones to watch, and then we bring up Goodbye, Uncle Tom. and we both say kind of how it's a very well-made film, and there's nothing like it. But, man, if you listen to our mood during that conversation, it's a lot different than those other movies. And that's not to say that Goodbye, Uncle Tom's not good. It just shows you that it strikes a chord with people. And, you know, this is another movie that I think it would actually do that. Not with hardcore people, you know what I mean? If you've seen all kinds of stuff like this, you're not going to flinch at it.
Well, and I think the issue in Uncle Tom's Cabin in this is Uncle Tom's Cabin can take a hardened exploitation crowd and have them going, oh, Jesus. You know,
yeah.
even people who watch exploitation movies all the time are going to be like, oh, okay, that's that, yikes. And, you know, it's funny that you say that because, yeah, this movie might offend people. But I'm sitting there going, well, you know, it's an exploitation. My reaction when you said it is, well, it's an exploitation movie.
Yep.
They mean to offend. They mean to push that envelope.
But the funny thing is, too, and I guess I kind of have a bit of affection for directors like this, too. There's directors that make movies that have stuff in it that will offend you, okay? And then there's these directors that not only do they have stuff in a movie that will offend you, but they seem to wallow in it like a pig does in its own shit. You know what I mean? It's really like they're just loving it the whole time. And this is one of those movies. And that really, that's why I like this movie. You know what I mean? There's something to be said about a really sleazy movie that you could just tell it's immersing itself in it and doesn't give a fuck if it's making you mad. It's really kind of like laughing at you the whole time. You know, I mean, that's what I like about it. It's definitely a worthy viewing experience, in my opinion. And it's not the harshest film in the world. You know what I mean? I don't want to bring it off like that because it's not, but it's pretty nihilistic and it's pretty unrelenting at certain points. And I mean, that's it. And it doesn't pull any punches. You know, I think that a lot of people that even have seen Last House on the left but haven't seen this one might, you know, there's something here for them. It's definitely a movie you should see if you're a fan of Last House.
Well, yeah, and I guess the other thing is I agree with everything you just said,
mm-hmm.
but I also feel like the movie just really, I don't know, maybe it's going to make me sound like a terrible human being, but it's entertaining as hell.
It is.
I mean, the direction and the setup is there's always action happening when it comes on. And a lot of times you can kind of – I mean, if you've seen exploitation movies, you know what's coming next
mm-hmm.
in this one. It's like, oh, here comes the next one. Oh, God, here we go. But it hits all the marks, and it drives home what it wants to drive home. And see, I don't know, dude. I know you say nihilistic, but I kind of found the ending – and maybe, again, it's just my twisted sense of humor – I found the ending kind of uplifting because I love movies. You know what I hate? I hate a movie where another human being does something incredibly shitty to another person, and when the credits are rolling, walks away scot-free.
Yeah.
So
absolutely,
you can do all sorts of horrendous shit to people during a movie, but if that last scene is that son of a bitch getting what's coming to him, I'm all good. And this movie definitely gives you that. He got what's coming to him.
Yeah, I won't argue with that. I mean, the reason why I brought up the nihilism is due to, like, there's one particular rape scene in the movie that isn't extremely graphic, but it's very unsettling.
Oh yeah,
and it's one where they're like zooming in on the guy's face, mm-hmm. and it's such a weird contrast. I'm sure like most of the people that listen to this have seen tons of movies with rape in them.
Yes.
Okay, we've seen the rape scene done a million different times. But watching Last House on the Beach, I was actually kind of surprised during that rape scene because it kind of hit me a little bit different than a lot of the other ones do. And put it this way, as bad as it is to watch a rape scene or uncomfortable it is or what have you, it's something else to watch a rape scene like the one in this movie where the filmmaker is basically making you wallow in some kind of scumbag's pleasure of rape. Like, yes. Instead of focusing on the act itself, they're focusing on the guy's face and his emotions during this whole thing.
Which
and it's
weird.
Really unsettling. It's a disturbing scene.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but it is really weird because instead of seeing it from a sort of a, I wouldn't say medical, but sort of a voyeuristic way where you're just watching the whole act, or a lot of them will focus on the victim so you kind of relate to the victim, which mm-hmm. can be disturbing. I guess maybe it's even more disturbing to sit there and focus on the rapist so that you're being forced to relate with what his experience is.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost
and another thing that I think that's really unique and great about that scene too is it kind of I mean, just watching that scene alone, this is just a guess. I don't know this for sure. But I would have to think that the director has a different outlook on rape than most people would. And he's not in a good way either. I mean,
yeah.
it's a really negative outlook on that type of act. And most of the time in these types of movies, like I said earlier, with the rape scene, they're very impersonal scenes. You know what I mean? You're kind of just like, you know, a fly on the wall. This one, they're getting you purposely involved in, whether you like it or not. And then it kind of shows you how, in the act of rape alone, the woman is basically a throwaway. You know what I mean? Because in this movie, during that scene, they're not even showing the woman. It's like she's not even there. It's like this is something you're seeing in the guy's head. You know what I mean? So it kind of really shows you the devalued, you know, nature that is just embedded in rape as is. You know what I mean? I know it might sound like we're overanalyzing this, but I think it's a really brilliant strategy to do it. You know what I mean?
And I don't, you know, I was about, as we were talking, I was sitting there going, I find it interesting. So you say maybe you don't want to overanalyze it, but So many people that are casual fans of exploitation movies or who aren't fans and who have never really seen them or gotten into them probably think that exploitation movies are shit.
Mm-hmm.
That they're just shocking things put together and thrown on screen. And some of them are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But then there are other movies that fall into that exploitation genre, like this one, like Last House on the Left, that actually are very well-made films, are brilliantly filmed, shot, and presented by people with a lot of talent and put mm-hmm. a lot of thought into it. So mm-hmm. I'm sitting here going, you know, I don't think we're overanalyzing. I think we're finally, we're maybe just by a discussion showing there's a lot to these movies. Like you say, you talked about how the rape shot, scene was shot. Most people go, oh, God, there's two rape scenes. And not even think about, but were they shot in a way that sucked you into the story? I mean, not every story has to be a Disney movie. Every movie has to be a Disney movie. Some of them can be unpleasant and show you unpleasant things like this.
Yeah, so, I completely agree. And you know, something else, too, and this is something that I really wanted to mention when we did this segment. This is a movie that a lot of people, myself included, were waiting a long time for. It just didn't seem like a lot of companies were interested in releasing it. And I find that, you know, in the realm of exploitation films, The Last House on the Left and its ripoffs are extremely important. They should be out there for people to view. They're usually better films than the majority of the exploitation films out there. I give Severin a lot of credit for not only releasing this, but rehauling the whole thing. It looks great. And there's some great extras on here, too. You know, I mean, thankfully, Severin's out there. And I'm not just saying that because we're doing this show on them. I'm really, really pleased and thankful that they're the company that handled this release because I think it's a great disc.
Severin puts out a lot of great movies, and I agree with you on that, too. We're talking about a couple more here. But, you know, they are amongst a small core group of DVD companies that not only put these things out but give them their due. I mean, I shall not name this company because I refuse to say the name of this company on the show, but there is a large company with much resources that put out a long-awaited slasher film and managed to not even give you a friggin' widescreen. So
yeah.
We have to appreciate the good companies.
Yes. We'll just call them Mayan's Fate on here.
All right. Yeah. And it might have been some sort of school-related slasher film. Which,
yes.
I keep bitching about that, but it's true. I mean, I want to give companies like Severin props because they take – you know, I talked to David Gregory, and I don't know if this made it into the interview or not, but they take a risk on some of these movies that they don't know – I mean, they put resources behind them, and they don't know if they're going to sell enough to recoup their money. So when they take a risk on a movie like this, and we all enjoy it, it's one of those things where, you know, man, we need to support them because – people don't get it. If they don't make the money off of this release, maybe the next release can't happen.
Absolutely.
I know that's also the case with companies like Grindhouse
Blue Underground.
Releasing.
Blue Underground's the same way,
yeah.
too.
So yep. We got to support these companies. And here's my final word on this movie. If you're an exploitation fan, if you love Last House on the Left, you need to go out and buy this movie.
Absolutely.
Blind by it. It's coming with recommendations. It is a great movie. Now, if you're not a fan of Last House on the Left, and you're not a fan of those sort of exploitation movies, yeah, maybe this isn't the one for you. But the neat thing is how we're discussing the movies we're discussing today kind of covers the whole spectrum of fans. So I guarantee you one of the three we talk about will be for you. Maybe this one's not right for you, but I'm telling you, this is worth – if you know you like these kinds of movies, this is worth a blind buy. And go support Severin.
Absolutely. And this is a great title to do it with, too, because I'm telling you, it's a can't-miss title. I was really blown away by this one. I really like the movie a lot. And like I said, the disc is outstanding.
Yeah, and it was long awaited by fans. So, seriously, I don't think I've ever... You know, you always hear people that don't like these kinds of movies, and I understand that. But most of the time, if you look at the history of the people that don't like the movies or you read their other reviews, it was pretty obvious this wasn't going to be their kind of movie. Most of the people who are into the exploitation movies and who enjoy this kind of thing, or at least understand it, like you and I, this movie was made for us.
Absolutely, man.
We're the audience it was made for, and it delivers everything you could want.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I know we sit here and you know, like how we said it's a Last House ripoff. It is. But on the same token, though, it's not. There's enough stuff changed around, and they're taking the film in a different direction, and it has different types of characters. So it's very similar to Last House, but there's a lot of stuff there that, you know, like maybe I could put it this way. If you're not a fan of Last House on the Left because you feel it's too mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's just a really dark film. I won't say don't watch this one because you might actually get something out of this one. It's a different presentation of that type of story.
Yeah.
And I think that if that's the thing that bothers you about Last House, some of these other ones might have stuff in them, you know, for you.
True. So, well, you think we've covered this one good?
I think so.
Excellent. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, let's talk a little bit about old Jesus Franco.
Oh, yeah.
Jess Franco classic. And I do think this is a classic film from Jess Franco.
Ditto.
Bloody Moon.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll be back on the Gut Munchers podcast right after this.
Hey, fans. It's Ken Forey. Just want to tell you about Mail Order Zombie. Great company. They review zombie films, any zombie film, every zombie film, and it's something you should tune into. So if you get a chance, go to the website, look these guys up, Mail Order Zombie, and find out what the hot zombie films are today. What's going on? These guys are right on the cutting edge of reviewing zombie movies. And if you're a zombie, or you want to be a zombie, or you're thinking about being a zombie, or your mom's a zombie, your dad's a zombie, or your damn mother-in-law's a zombie, tune in to Mail Order Zombie, baby. You'll find out what's going on. Ken Forey, and that's out.
Death Nerve, the first motion picture to require face-to-face warning. Every ticket holder must pass through the theater's final warning station. We must warn you face-to-face.
Warning.
Are you aware that twitch of the death nerve contains scenes which may be the stimulus that initiates psychological shock?
Warning.
During scenes of intense shock, do not attempt to leave your seat. If necessary, close your eyes, but remain seated until you have regained your composure.
Warning.
There are 13 periods of intense shock. Do not subject yourself to more than one strong reaction.
Warning.
Diabolical, fiendish, savage. You may not walk away from this one.
And we're back on the Gut Munchers podcast. Let's talk a little bit about Bloody Moon.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So before I go into the plot synopsis, just to give you guys an idea what we're talking about, Jess Franco, famous for the Emmanuel films, and or at least he did a couple, and basically a lot of, shall we say, sexploitation movies. Would you think that would be an accurate description of Jess's career, a big chunk of it?
Very much so, yeah.
He did his take on a slasher movie. Mm-hmm. And the movie opens up with at a masquerade ball, and there's a guy that has a disfigured face, but you don't know because it's behind a mask, and he's getting with the girl, and then she takes the mask off and realizes who he is, and he kills her and gets sent to a nut house because, you know, you kill somebody because they don't want to have sex with you after working you up.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that makes you crazy, so...
Apparently.
So, and then it fast forwards to, I don't know, a number of years later. And I don't think it ever really tells you how far ahead in the future, but it's not that far.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this, it's a wonderful setup for a slasher film. There is a language school filled with a bunch of young, beautiful ladies who like to get into various stages of bikinis and disrobing and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're at this language school to learn, I think it's Spanish or something, but it's they're learning a bunch of different languages. And I don't actually know that what they're learning is what we're learning, because, you know, the whole thing is subtitled, so who the hell knows. But there's one young lady, and her name is, I believe Angela is the lead character. Mm-hmm. And Angela notices that her friends start to disappear. As an audience, we know the bad things are happening to them and that somebody's picking them off. And Angela eventually tries to convince people at the school that bad things are happening. All while, you know, people are disappearing, and then I think she finds a body and flips the hell out and goes to the people that run the school and like, oh my God, there's somebody killing everybody. You know, as an audience, we've seen all these like brutal killings, and we know that somebody is out there killing people, including a very funny doing away with of a kid that I think is sort of like
expected,
but an awesome Jess Franco touch. I'm like, holy shit, that's awesome.
Yes.
Anyway. And, of course, there's a very iconic kill with a buzzsaw and stuff, which I'm sure we'll end up talking about. But after all the killings, you get to the end of the movie, and there's some twists. There's lots of red herrings, lots of possible suspects, and there's a big reveal, and it's very satisfying. And before I go to you, I'm just going to say this, and I never thought I would say this about a Jess Franco movie.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is awesome.
Oh yeah,
and I've said that about other Jess Franco movies, but what I would normally never have thought I would ever said, this has probably one of the most interesting, complex, maybe not complex, but very interesting and well thought out plots of any Franco movie I've ever seen, and it really does deliver, and it's a very interesting take on a slasher movie. It gives you what the traditional things you want with the blood and gore. And at the same time, gives you a great story with a lot of suspects, and it's not one of those movies where you'll figure out right away who did what.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I'm a big fan of Bloody Moon. You know, me and you have actually had a lot of conversations about this, not on the show, but just, you know, off the air. Regardless of the types of movies Jess Franco makes, regardless of how bad the stories are, how stupid the movies are, what have you, Jess Franco has always been the type of guy to me, and I know you feel this way too because you said it to me, he can shoot. He knows how to shoot a competent, decent-looking movie. So, you know, considering a lot of the people that made slasher movies in the 80s couldn't make a movie for fuck, this is what makes this movie impressive to me. It's there's a little style in there. It's well shot, and you know, it's a very it's basically like how earlier when we were talking about Last House on the Beach, we talk about ripoffs and how they can be good. I mean, this is basically just Jess Franco trying his hand at making a slasher movie or a body count movie, and he gets a passing grade for it. You know what I mean? I think it's a really solid movie. You know, there's some funny stuff in it, too. You know, I don't know if you noticed this or not, but I noticed it watching again the other day, and this might be coincidence or not, but there's one, you know, a few particular scenes, but one specific that comes to mind in which they're going into, like, an apartment or a room at this school. And the address is 13.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, and I mean, the only reason why it really, really played into my head like this is because the number 13 gets the Jess Franco Zoom specialty that he does in a lot of his films. So
take your attention to something without being beating you over the head with it.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like, you know, 13 in that movie, he's trying to make his version of the slasher movie. There's no doubt that he had seen Friday the 13th. So I thought that was kind of funny. And I mean, there's some corny, stupid stuff in this movie, too. I don't want to, you know, sit here and make this movie sound like it's the greatest slasher film ever seen. It's just Jess Franco's version of a slasher movie, but it's pretty effective. There's some good gore, and I don't know if you think this way about the movie, but you know, this movie, there's some kills, you know, in the movie when you're watching it, and it's kind of flowing along, and there's not a lot of gore and stuff, and then the movie hits this one point where it's like completely nuts after that point.
Mm-hmm.
Like once it hits that wall, it's like, okay, now's where all the mean-spirited kills come, and this is where all the bloodletting happens, and it's kind of a weird contrast. It's like maybe in the middle of filming the movie, Jess Franco's like, okay, time to put a bunch of fucking gore in it now. And I really like it. You know, it's not a bad thing at all, but I'm definitely a fan of this movie, and I definitely recommend it for people to check out.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. I love it has a slow build-up. but not like boring buildup. It's very interesting. It builds some atmosphere. Like you say, Jess Franco knows how to shoot a movie. And this movie, just the way it's shot from the opening scenes, it's got a really creepy kind of atmosphere to it. It builds and it builds and it builds. And then when it finally gets to the end, that whole last final showdown thing, it's an excellent payoff. And story-wise, it's very solid. It's very cool. There's little homages in there. This movie shot, I think, in 81. And like you said, he was clearly aware of Friday the 13th. And as far as a slasher movie, traditional slasher movie, you see some beautiful ladies. That's required.
Oh, yeah.
Good kills that are memorable. That's required. And a killer that has a unique kind of look or feel. And that actually is delivered, too. But you don't see it till towards the end, really, to know what's going on. But there's an interesting – the twist and everything works very well. And it works. So it, from a traditional slasher standpoint, where I'm just judging like any slasher I'd be watching, it has them. But then what for me, what puts this movie over the edge is, number one, it's Jess Franco. So for me to see a Franco movie with a solid plot that takes what he normally does really well and puts it with a solid plot and a solid story – that's, for me, just a no-brainer. It's going to be a good movie and something I really enjoy watching. But it has a European feel to it. So it's not really a giallo, but it has kind of like some of those giallo feel with the music and the scenery and some of the dubbing and stuff like that, right?
Absolutely. And then there was another thing, too, I was going to say, too, about that. And it takes a cue from the giallos as far as its storyline goes. Because once you see some of the stuff in the unfolding of the plot lines and whatnot, it's a lot closer to a giallo than it is a slasher. But, of course, it has the stock and slash like your typical slasher film has. And it's not presented as the black glove killer. It's not a giallo. But it's kind of like he's making a slasher movie, but borrowing from the story themes of a giallo. So I think that's what really makes this one solid, because you don't see too many movies that mixes the giallo and the slasher film.
And, you know, for me, again, it harkens back to films that I really like. I'm a big fan of the European stuff. So for me, it's like I'm getting delivered the slasher stuff that I like. I'm getting delivered a solid slasher film with all of these touches that reminds me of European films that I love. That I enjoy watching. So it just and it all comes together into this just package where it's a solid movie. It delivers the goods. It's fun. It's crazy at times. Jess Franco, I mean, I almost think there's certain things like with the kid, and I don't want to give too many spoilers, but there's a bit in there with the kid that you're like, nuh-uh, oh, crap. And then to me, that's almost like Jess Franco going, hey, you know, check it out.
Yeah,
I'll go where other people won't go.
And not only that, too, but there's one of the – I doubt it was done, you know, with humor in mind. But there's a specific scene we brought up earlier with the table saw, okay, where a woman is basically tied to a table and there's this giant saw that is threatening to kill her. And it's like the old James Bond thing with the laser, you know, like where it's like dun-dun-dun-dun and like the woman's getting closer to the saw, you know. And it has something to do with the kid. And literally one of the things that happens in this scene – okay, I think it's completely unintentional, but goddamn, is it funny. And it has something to do with a switch going on and off, but the way that they do it, it's like Jess Franco is doing a, oh, okay, everything's fine. And then it's like, no, it's not fine. And they do it literally that fast, and it's funny as hell. And it just really, I can't explain it without people seeing it, but it's so fucking funny to me that it's just kind of like a dark sense of humor. You know what I mean? Like when you wait for that last moment where the hero rushes in, you know, let's say it's like Superman. I'll just use an example. And it's like, you know, this kid's about to get hit by a bus and Superman comes down and he saves them. And then when he does it, a fucking airplane falls out of the sky and lands on his head. You know what I mean? It's like that kind of thing. Like, he saved the day. Nope. Boom. Wrong.
But you know what?
You know?
It's funny you say that, because I think I've seen some Jess Franco movies I've not liked, and then I've seen other ones that I've had fun with and I have enjoyed. And to me, I think Jess Franco himself as a person has a kind of a funny sense of humor. And if you watch the better Jess Franco movies, the movies that I think he's probably enjoying making and had some control over, they all, regardless of their genre or what he's shooting, they all have little funny bits in them. His best films. And I think it comes out here again, where I wouldn't call it slapstick, but there's definitely like a a little goofy kind of nod to the audience. I think I got the same kind of vibe with the kid, which is, it's not a terribly brutal thing, but it's kind of like, oh yeah, you know, we killed the kid. I mean, you know, and that's not, I'm sorry, but you guys probably at this point, it's a slasher film, and I keep talking about a kid, but you got to watch it. But anyway, it's like, oh yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, we'll do that. Nobody's safe. And it's just kind of a nod to the audience, in my opinion, that I think is kind of, I don't know. I just really love this movie.
Yeah, it's a very solid movie, too. And it's another thing that, like, I'm going to bring up again here about Severin. This is another title that's extremely important. A lot of people might not realize this, but this is one of the video nasties. Should it be a video nasty? That's a whole nother, you know, thing for another show. But it's an important film that a lot of people were looking forward to. And for the first time, uncut and uncensored, this is the DVD that it was on for American audiences. So it's another title that, and I know that, I don't know if you remember this or not, but remember about the time when they released this title, or when it was supposed to come out, it kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed. They were really, really putting a lot of effort into making sure that this was the best possible version of Bloody Moon that they could get. So I give them a lot of credit. I mean, a lot of people would have just put this movie out bare bones. Who gives a shit? Not remastering it. You know, I think there was another DVD of this one that was released years ago, but the print was horrible. It was completely cut up and almost unwatchable. Mm. So for Severin to take a hold of this and put it out with a great Jess Franco interview, I mean, that's the highlight for me on most of Jess Franco's movies is his interviews. And then a theatrical trailer, they rehauled it, has a brand new, you know, transfer and everything. It looks outstanding, and I definitely give Severin a lot of credit for doing that because it's another highly awaited film, and it's a slasher film, which, you know, horror fans seem to always be clamoring for more slasher movies.
And there's a lot of you guys out there that are giant fans of slasher movies, but you're not into, you know, you might not be into, I don't know, you know, like giallos or European films, and that kind of stuff bores you. This is a movie for you to cross over on. This mm-hmm. movie delivers the goods as a slasher film. If all you want to do is watch slasher movies, Bloody Moon is something that will deliver the goods and that you will enjoy. I promise you, you will enjoy it. And I can't recommend it enough. It's a great, solid movie, Jess Franco. I know a lot of you out there are like, I'm not watching a Jess Franco movie, and I don't blame you. I mean, his movies can be an acquired taste. I mean, I'm a fan, and there's even some Jess Franco movies that I roll my eyes at and have a hard time getting through. But this is a great, well-paced movie, wonderful story, delivers the goods. I keep mentioning there's a European flavor to it, but that's not going to get in your way. If you're just watching a movie for a body count and some, you know, what is it, blood, gore, and boobs and whatever, you're going to get it. You're going to get it, this movie.
Yep, and I would say that there's two movies that come to mind to me. Being a fan of slasher films, you know, as a kid and everything, and now obviously giallos, there's two gateway films to giallos for me. If there's American audiences out there thinking about getting into giallos and they don't really know where to start, there's two films where you need to start. Bloody Moon is a good way of doing that, and also Dario Argento's Tenebrae is another one. I think those are two really good gateway films because they appeal to the American audiences just as much as I think they would as a foreign one. So, and they're played very much like American films. So I definitely would recommend those two films, especially if you're thinking about, you know, where should I get into giallos? Those are two great films to start with and move on from there.
I also have another one, but it's really hard to get, and it's not as good as these other two, but it's one that's a personal favorite of mine.
What's that?
Another gateway film. And it's, believe it or not, from Lenzi, our good buddy Umberto Lenzi. Mm-hmm. Eyeball.
Yeah, I've heard that, actually.
Eyeball's a good flick.
Yeah, I've never seen Eyeball, but I've also heard that that's definitely another gateway flick. I agree.
It's a weird movie because it plays like a giallo and a slasher film, but the thing I love about it is, you know how you normally have your setting of a house or an apartment building or something?
Yeah.
The setting on this one moves. It's a tour group through Europe.
Oh, okay. There
so
you go.
Murders kind of follow them around. I think they're in Madrid. The murders follow them around to all the places they go in Madrid, so... yeah, so anyway, but not to get off track, though, but yeah, definitely. I you know, as far as, you know, you heard about gateway drugs. Well, gateway movie to get into European flicks is definitely one of them.
That's it.
And but again, even if that's not your thing and you know you don't like those movies, don't be scared off by the fact that Jess Franco flick, because it is, I would say right now, this is probably the best non-North American, because I want to include Canada, a lot of movies that try to be slasher films that weren't shot in the United States or Canada clearly don't work as slasher films. They might work on different levels. But for me, of anything that came out of Europe or the rest of the world that was trying to follow the slasher formula, the only one that I've seen that hits it on the head and delivers the goods is this one we're talking about right here, Bloody Moon.
Yeah, I won't argue with that. You know, as far as Jess Franco goes, I think there's, you know, at the top of his films from what I've seen, and I haven't seen everything, but I've seen the majority of his stuff. And it's Bloody Moon and Ilsa the Wicked Warden. Those, to me, are like two of his best films, and like not many of his other ones really get on that level. So, you know, I probably like the Wicked Warden a little bit better, but Bloody Moon's a damn fine film. It's a solid slasher, and you know, I think a lot of people out there who, you know, I know a lot of people, and I know you do too, that are always looking for slasher films, and a lot of them are VHSs of 80s movies, you know, American-made slashers and stuff like that. And if you've really, you know, ran the gamut on slasher movies, and you're looking for a new one that you haven't seen, or I should say, an old one that you haven't seen, Bloody Moon's also a great choice, so definitely come recommended for me.
Yeah, recommended for me too, and I'm the guy that just sat through Pranks last week, so still, it's better than that stupid Hide and Go Shriek, which is the worst freaking slasher movie I've seen. Well, I can't say worst anymore, but it's terrible.
Yes, it's terrible.
Timmy, that was a bad recommendation.
Yes, it's very bad.
So, alright, so that, and again, we have all these like inside jokes to people, our inside comments, but sorry, you know, it is what it is. It's the obnoxious show.
Yes.
Yes. But, again, Bloody Moon's good stuff. Love it. Great stuff. And I think we're going to come take a quick break. If you're talking about Bloody Moon, we'll take a quick break, and we're going to come back. Because remember what I said. I said a previous segment. Excuse me. If you're not into exploitation movies, maybe that one wasn't for you. Maybe this one was for you. But say somehow you stumbled upon the show and you're not into horror movies. I would say, why are you listening to Gut Munchers? But I'm not going to argue, because I don't want to lose our other fan.
Yes.
But say you don't like horror movies. Then you know what we're going to do for you? We're going to review another Severn title. With this Severn title, it's kind of an exploitation movie, but mostly, it's a war movie.
Yep.
World War II, going to get the Nazis, get them good. All right, so we will be back right after this on the Gut Munchers podcast to talk a little bit about the Inglorious Bastards. They're inglorious, and they are kind of bastards.
Yes.
But you know
so
what?
Let's go to, we're going to go to war after this. You know that?
There's not 12 of them.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. I wonder why 12 is an important number.
Maybe even a dozen?
Yeah,
of
not
them?
A dozen of them at all. So yeah. We'll be back to talk more about that right after this on the Gut Munchers podcast.
This is the movie that Rex Reed called the most horrifying motion picture I have ever seen. This film is positively ruthless in its attempt to drive you right out of your mind. This is the horror movie to end them all. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre from New Line Cinema. Rated R. No one under 17 admitted without parent or guardian.
Again, on the Gut Munchers podcast, we're going to talk about a war movie, which we had started to hint at previously on the other segment. It is Inglorious Bastards, and I'm going to let Ed go ahead and give you a plot synopsis.
Okay, here's the deal. We're in World War II. A group of American soldiers are being transferred over to like a military prison for all kinds of crimes. You know, you have some of them are thieves, some of them are murderers, some of them are traitors. You know, any kind of thing that a soldier would get in trouble in the military for is in this group of people. During the transport, though, their convoy is attacked by Nazis, and it leads to a group of guys basically escaping. Now, once they get out of here, you have like a handful of like some of course, they're criminals and thieves and whatnot, but you have some of the best group of soldiers that you can ever have together. And they decide that they need to get to Switzerland, which is a neutral country, where they could avoid prison and you know, for their crimes, basically. Along the way, they get caught up with some Frenchmen attempting to steal a warhead, which is like the prime German, you know, like military weapon. Okay. And basically what they have to do is break into a German protected area, steal the piece of military equipment, and obviously try not to get killed in the process or get caught by their own people as well. So not only are they against the Nazis, but their own people are looking for them too. So basically you have all this wrapped up into one, made from the genius of Italian crime films, Enzo Castellari. And what you have basically is a fantastic little war film with some great actors like Bo Svenson and Fred the Hammer Williamson. And, you know, it's just a really fun movie, a really cool movie. And it's, you know, if you've seen stuff like The Dirty Dozen, or if you just like general World War II movies, I would highly recommend that you get your ass out there and pick up Severance 3-disc set if it's still available. I don't even know if it is, but they have a fantastic 3-disc edition of this movie, and it has all kinds of special stuff on it, too. And it's another one, too, that Severn was originally supposed to put out and kept delaying it because they kept getting more and more stuff to put on the disc. And kudos to them for doing so, because this one is fan-fucking-tastic.
I agree. This is a badass movie. I mean, there's some movies that you watch that we've talked about, you know, very seriously about, you know, the first film, the exploitation and the camera work and the shots and the responses it generates out of the audience. And then the previous one, we talked a little bit about the story and the twisting and the mystery involved, as well as the delivering as a slasher film. And then there are some movies like this one that basically are like, okay, here we go. It is going to be a bunch of dudes with machine guns and other weapons cutting down Germans and getting out of impossible situations, and to get to the very end where they have to get this. I think they steal like the gyroscope or something out of the bomb for the Allies' military intelligence, and it's a body count movie. How many guys do we kill off before we get what we want? And how many of your heroes don't make it till the end of the movie? And do they all go out in good ways? It's very much a, you know, shall we say, it's very much a ripoff or an exploitation of The Dirty Dozen, which, you know, it's like we said before, if the movie delivers the goods and gives you what you want, then you can't complain about it. And this one, for me, delivers the goods. What I really liked about it, and I don't know what this obsession is that I have, but when you shoot a movie around, because it's not so much you're breaking into a base. They actually have to divert this train to get the bomb, the bomb piece. And the fact that it's built around kind of like hijacking the train and getting it away from them, I dig all of that. I really had a lot of fun with it. And I enjoyed how they handled it and how they handled the just the whole situation. And then, of course, it is an exploitation movie, so you have a random bevy of hot, blonde, naked chicks that are, you know, basically SS officers frolicking nude in a pond, and everything's hunky-dory until the hammer comes around the corner. Hello, ladies! And it's like, Americana, Americana! And then, and they're all, you have all these naked women bouncing to and fro, chasing them with the old German burp gun, machine guns, going brap, 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 trying to get them. And I thought that was friggin' awesome. And then the other thing that you didn't mention that I thought was a cool twist of the story is, you know, they're just trying to escape. And I think they run into a group of Germans, or they think they're Germans, and they end up gunning them down in a gunfight, and then discover they were like the American Special Forces team. That was sent there to get the bomb site. And then they run into the French, who think they're the team, and they're like, well, shit. So they're kind of stuck. And I don't know if they're kind of forced to be heroes, but they end up doing it. And, you know, the movie's just got a lot going on, but it's one goofy action scene or one goofy exploitation scene after another. And the performances are, you know, they're right for the material, which is Bo Svenson, the Hammer. They're just chewing through scenery.
Mm-hmm.
But it works. It works, and it's funny.
Yeah, I completely agree, man. I just, there's something about any kind of a movie where they have cool characters, and that's exactly to me what Bo Svenson and Fred Williamson are in this movie. And it's basically like this group of guys who you're kind of enjoying being on this trip with, and it's really fun because it's like, you know, they're trying to escape, and then they reach a roadblock where something's happening, and then they get around that roadblock, and it's kind of like you said, like about whenever they accidentally kill the American forces, or the secret force that's there. And it's like, God damn it, are you serious? Okay, now we have to do this. And like, no matter what they do, there's certain roadblocks that come up, and it makes it fun and funny. Yeah. And the characters kind of wallow in it, which I like too. And, you know, it's a really, and I know this is going to sound strange to a lot of people, but it's a really fun war movie.
It is, because it's not really realistic. It's not Saving Private Ryan. You don't really feel like you're there. This is one of those goofy war movies. It's kind of like the A-Team. You see the guy throw the grenade. You see the bomb, or you see the charge clearly go off behind the guys, and they're propelled on the springboards. Like, ah, thud! You know, it's one of those movies. It's also shot on quite a small budget. So you're not getting any large scale war scenes. And if you pay attention closely, actually, you will see the same actors dying as Germans, and again later on dressed in different clothes as French resistance guys. So. Shot on a really small budget, but who the hell cares? It's just a balls-out fun movie. They're not trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, and the real strong point in this movie to me is, you know, the movie is very knowledgeable about who its important characters are, mm-hmm. and who isn't. And the thing is, they take the time needed to establish and use the developed characters. But they don't waste your time on crap with other people. No. You know what I mean? There's very, very little wasted motion in the movie. So, like, the characters that they put something into are important, and you feel that way. And the characters that aren't, you know they're not important. You know they're just there for decoration, and they'll be gone within time. And it's a very, very knowledgeable way of doing that. They use the devices of characters pretty well in this movie. And I think that's basically what makes it so good. You know what I mean? You have a lot of cool characters. You're getting into them. They have some meaty roles. Like, there's some stuff there for them. And it's good. You know what I mean? And it's like Fred Williamson, notorious movie tough guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
They give him a tough guy role, and they let him roll with it. You know what I mean? So it's they're very knowledgeable about the type of characters they have in this movie, and they're very knowledgeable about how to use the actors that they have to their strengths.
Yeah, and it just... I don't know. You could tell that you can tell that the guys behind this movie, director, producer, everybody involved, knew how to make a film.
Mm-hmm.
It might not have been a large budget, large scale film, but they clearly knew how to use their resources because it's well paced. It looks like every dollar they could afford, they put up on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I think they really kind of focused a lot of resources on the whole train scene.
Mm-hmm.
And shooting that stuff on the train towards the end, and it works. It works great.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's just a really solid movie, man. I mean, this is another one too that and it's the running theme here of the show apparently, but Severin really does go above and beyond to try and put out great DVDs for movies that fans are clamoring for.
Yep.
And, you know, this is one of, like, I know we talked about the last two movies as being long awaited films, but this is another one that I know a lot of people are really looking forward to. And that's the thing. I mean, Severin made a 3-disc collection for this. And this is something too that I wanted to mention about Severin, because this is the only title we talked about on here that's like this, but there's a lot of different, a lot of different sets that they have made and done like this, where the 3rd disc is actually a CD of the soundtrack of the film.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is fantastic. You have two discs on here of the movie and great. I mean, there's a ton of special features on this three-disc set. And then on top of it, you get the soundtrack. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I have the two-disc set, so I'm missing the soundtrack. But the special features on this are really good. Though, I'm not going to lie. There's an interview with Quentin Tarantino talking to the director, Enzo Castellari.
Mm-hmm.
I can't ever say his name, which is why I would try and avoid saying it. But I kind of, partway through that special feature, I actually said out loud, man, can Quentin Tarantino shut the hell up and let this guy talk?
Yeah, I agree.
So, it's not bad. I mean, no, you know, and I'm a Quentin Tarantino fan. It's just, he's such a nerd for this movie. He wouldn't let the director actually finish a sentence at points, I feel like, so.
Yeah. It's kind of funny to watch Tarantino nerd out about talking to Castellari, which I thought was kind of cool. And, you know, that's the thing, too. That's another one of the reasons why I remember this kept getting delayed, is because they were supposed to have access to Enzo Castellari. He got ill, and then they were just going to release it. And then they said, you know what? No, we're going to wait. And they waited. And I think they got a lot of positive stuff from doing that. You know what I mean? So it just shows you the dedication that Severin has towards their films. They're not just going to throw out any crappy version of a movie just to get it out there. They want to add stuff for people like us, which, you know, I have to say, and I'm not speaking for you, but I would just, you know, just out of my own thoughts and curiosities, I would have to say that that's a big reason why this show that we're doing right here is happening, because we feel that there's a certain value to Severin as a company.
Absolutely.
For people like us, you know, there's a lot of value that a lot of companies have. Don't get me wrong, but they're not putting out stuff for us. Severin is specifically putting stuff like this out with people like us in mind.
And, you know, and that's the whole point. That was the whole point of the Blue Underground show, and that's the whole point of, like, you know, in the Severin show, we didn't mean to do it so quickly afterwards, but the David Gregory interview came, so we thought it would make sense to cover some of the Severin titles to kind of, when I put these shows together, I like to do a theme if possible. And I can be honest with you, it's like I said, there are some companies out there that put out shit for the fans, but they're like, they put no effort in it because they know the people are going to let them buy them no matter what crappy version they put out.
Mm-hmm.
And we've already mentioned one of them. And you know, that's bullshit in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then there are other companies that go that extra mile, that actually put the effort into it. And we've talked about three Severin films, which we like. But you know, the weird thing is if you look at some of like the European sexploitation titles, some of the Jess Franco titles, some of the, you know, they put a lot of effort into these movies that, mm-hmm. and you know, every Franco movie that the Severin has put out, I think everyone that put out has a Franco interview in it.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's a lot of effort to put into a movie. You might not move a ton. Because, you know, yeah, the Emmanuel movies might sell, but how many people are actually lining up to buy the women in prison films? But Severin consistently puts effort into everything they do. And I know you're not a huge fan of The Sinful Dwarf. Mm-hmm. I kind of found it weird, but there's like a crazy amount of work and effort put into what is an incredibly obscure movie.
Yeah, and you know what's funny about that too, actually, was there at the time, I guess, when they were putting it out, I think this might be in your interview, I'm not 100% sure, but The Sinful Dwarf was actually being put out by Something Weird Video.
Yeah.
And, the people at Severin really wanted to put it out. And, you know, nothing against Something Weird, because I think they do a lot of great stuff, too, for exploitation films and for even old-school horror films or just B-movies in general. But they don't put the effort into remastering and all that stuff. You know what I mean? So when a company like Severin can do that and pick the movie up and add some special features to it, and they actually go the extra mile for you. You know, and it's cool on top of that because, you know, of course, everybody looks at special features as getting more for their money. You know what I mean? On each DVD that they buy, the more special features, well, it's more for my money. But, and of course it is. But another thing that I don't think people look at enough with special features is on a lot of these films, this isn't just a special feature giving you more for your money. It's also a company trying to preserve the background of these films.
Yeah.
You know, when they have all these Jess Franco interviews, a lot of people might think, oh, that's stupid to do that. Who cares what he thinks? But they're actually getting insight into a film and putting it on a DVD that 30 years from now, when Jess Franco is no longer with us, we're going to have that information. You know what I mean? So these films are not only just getting exposed in a good way, but they're also preserving information and stuff about the films and how they're made and about the director and everything else for years to come. And that's extremely important. And I don't think that emphasis is strong enough for fans, I think. I think they just look at it as more for my money. But they're really going above and beyond to preserve as much information and as much of the insight that goes into making these films. And that's extremely important to me.
I agree with that, and I don't know. I just appreciate a lot of the stuff that they're doing, and I guess to get back to Inglourious Basterds, I just think this is. I have to say this about all three movies. It shocks me that it took so long for them to come out on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
These aren't obscure titles. These aren't titles where I'm like, well, I can see why that's not on a DVD, or I can see why that took so long.
Mm-hmm.
You have Jess Franco, who is very well known. Yeah, Bloody Moon is a solid slasher flick.
Mm-hmm.
Last House on the Beach is a solid entry into what I'd like to call, you know, Last House on the Left ripoffs, or can we make that a exploitation? A Last House on the Left exploitation.
Yes.
Whatever you want to call it. But it's a great movie, worth watching. And then this one, this last one, I mean, this thing was on TV all the damn time when I was growing up as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cut up, obviously, without some of the parts in there. But it was one of those, like, you know, easy to check out on Saturday afternoon or, you know, war movies. And, you know, it was just one of those things that was out there a whole lot back in the days before cable when UHF channels used to pick up stuff like this for the cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good movie. It's a solid film. It's again by another big name director that's well known in a completely different genre. But it's like, why did it take so long to come out?
Yeah, it has to do, I'm sure, with money. Because the thing is, as far as a lot of these titles go, the foreign ones that seem to be the most expensive for DVD companies to acquire are the ones done by people with cult followings. And, I mean, if you look at this film, it has Bo Svenson in it and Fred Williamson. We both know their cult appeal. Enzo Castellari is the director, another guy who has a gigantic, list of films that he's made over the years. He's a well-known cult figure, too. So it's probably the money. And you would have to assume that – and I hate to say this, too, because it hurts a lot of companies, but I'm kind of glad that some of the rights for these movies are expensive, because then the companies that would just want to come pick up something on the cheap and put it out are kind of thrown out of the equation, while the companies that really will, you know, like Severin, that will pay the money and go the extra mile for the title, and it's like, well, we might as well make a 3-disc because we had to pay enough for the rights. You know what I mean? It really kind of makes them go the extra mile and put the extra work into it that you know, make us appreciate these titles. So that's great, too.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying, I guess, in a way. But, you know, it's funny because that reminds me, and here we're going off the topic again, but, you know, we were talking about something similar recently, and I think it can backfire on you, too, and make your movies not as available as they should be. Because, you know, the name, when you were saying about, like, very expensive to get, cult and everything,
mm-hmm.
You know, the name popped into my head and somebody we were talking about recently.
What's that?
Russ Meyer.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
There's a guy whose movie should be out there. People should be eating these things up. He made some just goofy, awesome, wacky stuff, and he's not out there like he should be.
Yeah, and the only reason I don't have a problem with that as much is because I do from what I understand, I could be wrong on this, but Russ Meyer's films, after he passed away, were, you know, written up in a will, basically, and made into, like, what I would consider to be some sort of a trust. Because the people that own the rights to his films are the people that were given the rights by him.
Mm-hmm.
And they sell them exclusively through a website. And I know that some people might be upset about that. But you know what the thing is?
Aren't they really expensive, though?
They are. But the thing is, though, that this – I'm sure Russ Meyer's movies are trying to attempt to feed generations in his family. So it's like they don't really need to sell as many copies as a Severin would or what have you to make a significant amount of money off the titles.
But you know, dude,
so,
You know, dude, though, here's the thing I think is backfiring. This is my take on it.
Mm-hmm.
You and I know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
We probably like his movies.
Mm-hmm.
How many Russ Meyer movies you own?
Maybe two.
Yeah. I don't know.
And they're bootlegs, so.
So how many legit Russ Meyer
Zero.
Movies you own?
Right. Zero. Yeah.
It's the same amount that I own.
Yep.
If this was something that I could pop onto a deep discount and get for $10, if I could go get a copy of Faster Pussycat Kill Kill for $10, I would own one. And I would show my friends, and they would know what that movie was. And they would know this guy's name. Because the generation of people that saw his stuff in the theaters
mm-hmm.
are dying off.
Mm-hmm.
And there are hardcore collectors like you and I who know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
But neither one of us will spend the money on his films.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess it's the one thing that I do kind of admire about the whole thing as well is, you know, when a lot of people talk about independent cinema, mm-hmm. and a lot of times when people are talking about that, it's just nonsense. But Russ Meyer actually is the truest sense of independent, because nobody owns his films but his trust. You know what I mean? His films were made off. He got the money together to make his films. There was no studio involvement with those. And that's kind of a thing of the past. You know what I mean? He's a true, true legend in independent cinema because of that. You know, people could talk about Lloyd Kaufman and people like that all they want, but Lloyd Kaufman has conformed a lot more than somebody like a Russ Meyer has. So, I mean, I guess with the best thing that we could hope is, if you remember a couple years back whenever Turner Classic Movies was doing the I forget what it was called, but they were showing the cult movies on the weekend and stuff.
Oh, they still do that. It's TCM Underground.
Yeah, exactly. And they actually showed Faster Pussycat Kill Kill on there.
Yep.
You know, hopefully that will be the way that people could kind of discover his best films. I mean, most of his movies you can't watch on TV because they're just topless films. But
I hate to interrupt, man. I understand where you're coming from, but my fear is that here in 20 years from now, I guarantee you there will be a cult following for H.G. Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Because the stuff's out there, people see it, people go, oh my God, they've remade it. And mm-hmm. There's a popularity to it. And I happen to think that Russ Meyer was probably as good of, and at times, a better filmmaker than H.G. Lewis.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid, because I do really like some of his movies, mm-hmm. I'm afraid the way they're being so tight with him, that he won't be remembered in 20 years. Maybe not by that big group. And H.G. Lewis has had, I mean, dude, if you there now, you know, you go to Wasteland, it's an oddball group, but if you go to most 20 some year old guys, they probably don't know who Russ Meyer is, unless it's because of the metal band that, you know, that did or not the metal band, but the band that did Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Mm-hmm.
That might be their only relation to even knowing about that movie. But a lot of guys have, because of the remake and because of how easy the movies are out there to see, know, like, you know, 2000 Maniacs. They know a lot of these other films. And it just
yeah.
bugs me that they might be making, they might be forcing him into obscurity that I don't think he deserves to be.
Well, in all fairness, and I don't want to get on a tangent here about Russ Meyer, but, you know, sadly, and Faster Pussycat is not one of these films. Let me make that clear. And neither is Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. But most of his movies are basically, what's the right word? Like, they're just outdated. And I don't mean from a time standpoint. I mean, Russ Meyer was making titty movies before hardcore was fashionable and before it was legal. So almost now, with the whole adult industry being out there, his movies are kind of obsolete.
They're not hardcore and they're shot on film.
Exactly. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I guess maybe because there's not a big audience for softcore anymore.
True. I got to tell you, though, I did catch a couple of his movies
mm-hmm.
at Wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
And while it was strange watching some of those titty films in a room full of guys going, which is always a strange experience over there, they're pretty well made. I mean, I was like, there's some laughs in there that you don't expect. So
yeah.
They're well-made films, but I understand what you're saying. At least, though, you would think the family would be smart enough to make sure that – to keep his name out there for his better-known films to get a release. Because That guy is a legend in the drive-in circuit.
Yeah.
He is a legend, and every bit as big as H.G. Lewis, and I have watched over the last 10 to 15 years, if you kind of track, you know, name recognition, and it's kind of, it's just me talking here about what I've seen personally, less and less people know who Russ Meyer is, and it's more and more of a, and it's actually, you know, it's become one of those things. You know how when you measure somebody up at a convention when you first meet them, oh, you're in a drive-in movie, you start talking about H.G. Lewis, and you drop a Russ Meyer on them, and to see... Is this guy for real or not?
Yeah.
And it's started to get to the point where Russ Meyer is obscure enough, and I don't want to say obscure because there's a lot of us out there that know he is, but it's kind of one of those badges where you know H.G. Lewis, that's fine. Let's talk Russ Meyer. Oh, you know Russ Meyer. Oh, okay. And then, of course, my next one is I go really obscure and people scratch their head and think I'm retarded. And I go, well, what about Bill Remain?
Yeah.
Dude, shut the hell up. But yeah, you know, dude, it's just one of them things. I don't know. We've gone on a complete Russ Meyer tangent, but we tend to do that. And I don't care. It's my show.
I think people will dig it.
Yeah, well, if you don't dig it, you could just fast forward. You know, it could be worse. We could be talking about wrestling.
You know what? I'll say this. Here's a deal.
Come on, I just took a shot. I said we could be talking about wrestling.
Yeah, we could. But, you know.
Damn it.
I'm not going there, damn you.
We could talk about MMA. Which
yeah, we could.
It's probably seriously one of the gayest things I've ever seen.
Oh, you're crazy! MMA is awesome.
I watched one match, and basically, it was two guys getting all oiled up and sweaty, and then rolling around punching each other in the balls. I'm like, well,
yeah, well, that
I would imagine that would be how some gay porn starts. You know, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't know either because I don't particularly watch gay porn.
See, I took a shot at wrestling and MMA in one show.
I know. Yeah. We're fighting after the show's over, goddammit. That's
yeah,
it. I'm going to start taking fucking shots at Star Trek then. If you really need.
Take shots at the movie, dude. I hate that fucking movie.
Ugh, Jesus. But, yeah, but I mean, I don't know. Back real quick here to Russ Meyer, though. I mean, I think that there will always be some sort of an interest in Russ Meyer due to the fact that there were so many people influenced by him, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'll be honest with you. It's fairly simple, and I know that it's something that's been talked about a lot, actually. And I kind of hope he doesn't do it. But Quentin Tarantino's talked a lot about remaking Faster Pussycat. If somebody like him would actually touch that movie and remake it, I think you will see a renewed interest in Russ Meyer's movies. And plus,
DVD releases of some of his titles.
You know what? I'll be honest with you. I don't even think DVD is on the radar for that right now. I think maybe people would be looking towards maybe seeing Russ Meyer stuff on Blu-ray at some point. But just because it's the next format, I don't really think that anybody's going to touch DVD now because the money to be made has already been made. So
you know what? I disagree. Blu-ray is the next Laserdisc.
I hope so. I just don't
believe that.
Put it this way. Even if the Russ Meyer stuff was to hit home video on a bigger scale than it is now, it's not going to be for a few years.
True.
You know, it's put it this way, either Blu-ray is going to thrive and survive or it's going to die and DVD is going to continue on. Once that decision's been made, maybe I think we might see some of these. But until then, I think everything's just going to stay the same.
All I can say is I've started paying attention. And this is just my one little side note to a side note to a side note. My one thing I'll say about Blu-ray is I've started to watch. My Best Buy had really expanded their Blu-ray section,
mm-hmm.
and it's shrinking.
You know
and
what?
I've looked at other places. They do the new releases. They get a really heavy Blu-ray push, but I've noticed that they're still. It looked like they had a real commitment to Blu-ray, and then they've backed off. And I think it's the economy.
Yeah.
And I think it's that they realize they'll move a. If you stack the shelves with DVDs that are in the $9 to $10 range, you'll blow them off the shelf.
Yeah, and you know another thing that's interesting too, just to add into that. Recently, my Walmart's been completely rehauling their store. They're setting everything up differently and remodeling. And I was surprised to see that their whole electronics section had been overhauled.
Yeah.
And what they did is, believe it or not, you know how they used to have them $5 DVD bins?
Mm-hmm.
Now, those movies each have individual shelf space.
Yep.
So they really expanded their DVD section, and the Blu-ray section is exactly as small as it was before.
Because they realized they were selling a ton of $5 DVDs, and they were making mm-hmm. a ton of money on them. So,
and I have to think too that a lot of the people that you know have Blu-ray, I know a few that do this. They still do pick up DVD. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, why would you go buy a brand new movie for $25 on DVD or on Blu-ray when they have the same movie on DVD right across from it for $14?
Yep, unless it's something you really think you need to see in Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to get Iron Man or Spider-Man or something like that, then yeah, get the Blu-ray. But I mean, if there's a new DVD coming out of Nightmare on Elm Street or something, do you really need it on Blu-ray? It's not going to look that much better.
No, or if you're going to watch a shitty remake of Friday the 13th, do you really need to see it in high def?
Well, maybe, because maybe you'll see something in that movie that I didn't, because it sucks.
Yeah. All right. But, I tell you what, I think we've talked this to death, and we've completely gone off the path, which is what we tend to do, and I think that's part of the charm of the show.
Oh, yeah. Yes. That's what we'll call it, charm.
Yes, charm. not lack of focus, but just charm. So
yes.
We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll wrap things up.
Sounds good.
All right, we'll be back right after this on the Gut Munchers podcast.
Centronics International presents a terrifying journey into the supernatural, narrated by the master of slithering evil, Rod Serling.
Come now and explore the possibility of the impossible. It is tradition that ghosts and ghouls and various other citizens of the grotesque wrap themselves in malevolent mists and deep darkness. This is a terrifying encounter with the unknown.
Hello? Who is that? Oh, hi. What are you doing out in this mess?
One. Two.
You're doomed. You're all doomed.
Three.
We weren't doing anything. We were just messing up.
Four. Six.
It's been my imagination.
Seven.
And we're back for the final segment of another wonderful show. I think it's wonderful.
So do I.
Yeah. But that's because I'm awesome.
Yeah, and I'm on it, so.
There you go.
Yeah, so, what the hell.
So I think we had a good show. We talked to David Gregory, talked about three Severin titles, got sidetracked, managed to mention Russ Meyer. And, you know, whenever you can work Russ Meyer into a show without actually doing anything about Russ Meyer, that's pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah. And we're always impressive. Who are we kidding?
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah, we're awesome. So, I guess I should do some site business. We have another show coming up. Probably in a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks maybe. I might have a very big interview for that show, or I might not have it done yet. And if not, we'll move on to, we'll do something else. I'm not really sure what we're going to do with that show yet. I don't even know what movies we're going to do yet, but there will be another show. We're going to do a Mom and Pop video segment.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I do know in the future, we're going to have another one of our staff meetings. And I'm just trying to get the logistics worked out for that. So we'll have, hopefully have actually all four of us on this time to talk about a subject that I think was pretty neat. So I don't want to let that cat out of the bag either, but there's some cool stuff coming for the show. Also talk a little bit about the website, gutmunchers.com. The weekly webcomic is still going off like usual. Getting exciting, I think. I'm having some fun with it. I have written reviews up every day. Well, getting crazy with the YouTube. We between Jason and I and Steve on occasion, we have a YouTube segment up for the Gut Munchers YouTube page every day. So we got a lot of crap going on. And I know you got a lot of stuff going on over Blood Type, because as most of our loyal listeners know, both of them, you do BloodTypeOnline.com.
Sure do. Got all kinds of new videos coming on the way on the Blood Type YouTube channel. And, of course, we have written reviews weekly, all kinds of new stuff there as well. And also, because, see, this is how it is in the horror community. We're all friendly. So I want to extend something to the Gut Munchers listeners who might not check out Blood Type Online, okay? So just check this out. If you guys out there are as big fan of the show as I am, of the show Dexter, okay, I love the show. It's my favorite horror-related kind of show on TV. Season 3 is coming out on DVD. The cool people over at CBS and Paramount have given us a contest. We have 3 copies to give away. If you want to win one, all you need to do is just email me at bloodtypecontest@gmail.com. Put Dexter Season 3 in the subject line. Just send me your name and your address. We pick them at random. Contest is open to U.S. residents only. We would love to give you a free copy of Dexter. So definitely enter that. And, hey, you might get yourself a kick-ass little box set of Dexter Season 3.
Ha! You know what's funny?
What's that?
I completely forgot. We'll be running a Dexter contest. if you click on the link. So you got 2 chances to win, guys. 2 chances to win. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I completely forgot about that. I was going to update the site. So Monday morning, you guys will see the link to click on to join the contest. So, hey, you know what? Go ahead and try both sites.
Exactly. It gives you a better chance to win.
Yeah, we want to give stuff away. So, totally forgot about that.
And just 2 other quick things I wanted to mention. Obviously, as I mentioned on all these shows, support the independent horror sites. They're the sites that are not lying to you. We're not trying to push anything. We're not corporately sponsored or trying to make money off this stuff. We're just trying to tell you guys the best stuff to see. So obviously, check out all your independent horror sites out there, such as Gut Munchers and Blood Type Online. And one other thing I did want to mention, because it came up this week, and I know it's a guy that that we've both met on several occasions, and I've always thought it was a very, very nice guy, and is with his wife as well. But I wanted to mention the passing of Clayton Hill, known as the sweater zombie from the original Dawn of the Dead. Super nice guy. Had the opportunity to meet him a ton of times. He was a genuinely nice guy, and he will certainly be missed at conventions all over the country.
Clayton was a wonderful person, for sure. Like you, I got to meet him on more than one occasion. He was kind of a, you know, if there was going to be a convention and in this area and had anything to do with zombies, you knew Clayton and Sharon would be somewhere there. Mm-hmm. I think the last time I saw Clayton was over at Zombie Fest here a while back. But they were both very good people, very nice people. And, you know, man, it sucks. It's 2009 and, you know, we've got 41 years for, we got 41 years for Night and 31 for Dawn or 32 for Dawn or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course Day's got, you know, a good 20 some years on it. A lot of these people that we grew up watching and that we got chances to meet at conventions are gone. I mean, just think about the people 5 years ago that were still around from Night of the Living Dead you could meet and talk to and have signed materials. And so, you know, guys, when you get a chance to go to a convention, I know financially it's tough, and I'm not going to lie. I mean, Sharon and Clayton, I never got their autograph because they wanted $20, and I didn't do it. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't go over and talk to somebody and say hi and get to meet them, because I did get to talk to both of them on a couple occasions, and they were nice people. They had great stories. I got to see them on panels and talk about making the movies. So when you get a chance to go attend a convention, even if you're not going to get an autograph, take the time to stop by and talk to these actors. Take the time to sit in on the panels, because you never know when they're going to be gone. And yes, there's a lot of people go, well, he was just the sweater zombie. He was also really involved a lot behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And he had, unlike people who showed up on set, unlike some people who showed up on set and maybe, I don't know, dressed like a Mooney or Harry Krishner, and that's the best they got. He was actually involved in making the films. And you know what's going to be our luck, dude?
What's that?
It's the Kennedy theory of movie stars or movie people. We're going to get to the point to where everybody that we liked from like Night of the Living Dead is going to be passed away, except for John Russo.
Yeah.
Be like, I'm John Russo. I'm 107. Come see me. And it'll be like, oh, John Russo. Oh, cool. I actually got to meet somebody from the movie. It's like, damn it. No, damn it. That sucks. So
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And of course, and, you know, it's not a show until I can take a shot at John Russo. So
yeah.
You notice I only pick on celebrities that are much smaller than me that I could totally kick their ass.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. It happens.
It's self-preservation.
You know, but one of the things that I wanted to mention, too, real quick, and I mentioned it over at Blood Type on the little write-up I did, but Clayton actually served as a weapons coordinator on Dawn of the Dead, and almost about a decade ago, I'd say, I met him at the Pittsburgh Comic-Con. It was really slow on the day that I first met him, and I talked to him for a considerable amount of time with him and his wife, and he was selling bullets from the movie, like actually bullets shot from the film, and he actually gave me one for free.
Cool.
You know, generally it was a nice thing, and I still have it. It's still one of my prized horror memorabilia things in my collection. So I definitely, you know, that made my day, and it's very sad. You know, my condolences go out to obviously his wife, Sharon, and the rest of his friends and family out there as well. It's rather sad, and you know, the guy was always at conventions and stuff, and it was, you know, for a lot of people, it's their one way to meet somebody from Dawn of the Dead. Mm-hmm. You know, George Romero's a little bit more complicated to meet. This guy at least was doing the shows and would give you a chance to maybe come out and meet somebody that had something to do with the film. You know, if you don't get to make it to these huge conventions, you know, if you don't have the money to go, it was always nice to see him at shows, and you know, it's pretty sad.
Yep. It is. It's very sad. It's a sad thing to see, and it's just a, you know, fact of life, dude. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I almost forgotten I was going to mention it too. So this is what happens. You know, take time to show notes.
It happens. What are you going to do?
You know, if I actually prepared for these things, they wouldn't be as dynamic and awesome as they are.
Exactly, dynamic. That's the word we needed in there.
I'm a dynamic and awesome show host. Yeah,
show hoster.
So. But, well, I think they probably have wasted another two and a half hours listening to us go on and on and on about stuff that we're really smart about, and you should totally listen to us, because
yes,
we're super smart.
We're super geniuses.
Super geniuses, yeah. Not like baby geniuses, though.
No.
One of Bob Clark's made that. Films.
Oh, Jesus.
you gotta love Bob Clark. He did. He pretty much, I don't think he ever met a script he didn't like.
Yeah, and I mean, hey, you know, if you made Black Christmas and Death Dream and Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, then, you know, I'll give you a pass or two.
Yeah, well, don't forget Christmas Story.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a great one, too, but I was sticking to the horror stuff.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm pretentious.
Oh, well.
At least today I am.
This is the Pretentious Douchebag Podcast.
Yes.
Oh, wait, no, I've listened to those. Those aren't us.
I gotcha.
Okay. Anyway. So I think we're pretty much done here, unless you have something else you want to talk about.
I would go on for an extra hour about how awesome I am, but I doubt anybody wants to listen to that. So, no, I'm good.
And I would just edit it out anyway.
Good point.
You know. So
You're trying to destroy me with your editing, I think.
Oh, yeah, totally. I have to make myself, like, the center of attention.
Son of a bitch.
I'm a creep that way, but you know what? It's my show, damn it. I'm creatively in control.
Okay, if that's what you want to call it.
All right. Well, okay, we've reached the end of another show, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks to give you another entertaining hour or two. But until then, please continue to check us out at gunmetrics.com. Don't forget to check out bloodtypeonline.com. And check out the link sections on our web pages where we link to people that we like and they think are cool. Don't forget to check us out on YouTube at Gut Munchers user. Just if you pop on YouTube and type in Gut Munchers or type in Blood Type Online or Blood Type. Is this Blood Type?
Blood Type Online.
Blood Type Online. You will definitely find our YouTube pages. And if you find Ed's or mine, we're friended with each other as well as being friended with a lot of other cool cats on the whole YouTube scene. So I guess I could go through and mention a bunch of names. I always forget people. So if I just tell you to check out his friend list and my friend list, these are people, not friend lists, our subscribe lists. These are people we subscribe to and we really dig, and you should check them out. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So until for a couple of weeks from now, I'm John.
And I'm Ed.
And you've been listening to the Gut Munchers podcast. Goodbye.